around and introduce yourself, I'd appreciate it.
This is Henry Chung from Monocure CMO on the phone.
Anyone else on the phone? You may be muted. Maybe you want to unmute when you introduce yourself. Okay. Well, Henry, great. Thank you for joining us by phone. And we'll go around the room. Starting with Scott.
Only.
Sure. I'm Scott Braithwaite, Chief of the Section of Medallion Infectious Research at New York University.
And Kathy Shure with the Greater New York Hospital Association.
Dave Lehman, SUNY Syracuse.
Bob Corwin, pediatrician, Rochester, New York. And representing the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Ira Lanster, Columbia University College of Dental Medicine.
Peter Lilly, at Hospital Fund.
George Thomas, OBGYN, Mount Sinai School of Medicine. I work at Elmhurst, which is Health and Hospitals, and I'm here for ACOG.
Lucky you.
They're
there
for you, too.
I'm Bill
Gillespie, pediatrician, chief medical officer for Animal Health.
Paloma
Hernandez, CEO, Urban Health.
Ed Hannon, University of Albany.
Gene Hustlin, British Italian Medicine, chief of strategy for Hudson Valley Health Alliance.
Mark Gibson, director of the Center for Evidence Based Policy at Marine Health. Thank you.
I'm Doug DeLong. I'm an internist and geriatrician at Bassett Healthcare and representing the New York American College of Physicians.
Great. And I know we have a few folks, a small crowd here. If you could just go and introduce yourself. Laura, if you want to start by saying hello.
Sure. Laura Castle, the coordinator of Medicare Matters New York. Good morning. Doug Wendt, with American College of Physicians. I'm here with the Healthcare Association here. Laura, I'm
And we've got Foster up here rapidly collating papers. Henry, I don't know, did you receive an email with these proposals?
I did. Thank you.
Okay, good. Wow, we got it right. we have 11 proposals that we're going to discuss in detail today. I think we did a lot of work in the interim, and thank you all for giving feedback on these proposals. I think they turned out very nicely. I looked at prior to this version. I haven't seen the most recent version, but that's what we're all here for. Foster, do you want to take it from here?
Sure. Before we get to proposals, which we will likely pick up much of today, I just wanted to remind the group about sort of what happens after this in the timeline and process, and then we can talk a little bit about the process document and the principal document. There are some edits that we got the last meeting and also through email, and some continuing emails that you may have seen about some of the language and that we should try to finalize. In terms of the time frame, this is our last meeting. Following this meeting, our responsibility is to write a report. You've seen the template for that report. We've been given instructions to keep it simple, keep it concise, clearly, you know, outline the recommendations and make them, you know, as clear as possible, which is part of why we put all these recommendations in the format already. That report, after the group, you all get a chance to take a look at it, which also just describes our process, some of the discussions and the highlights. You folks will take a look at it and make sure that you're okay with. We will also, prior to the next MRT meeting, which is November 1st, try to send a version of this to both people MRT so that they have a chance to also weigh in and make comments. And part of that is a desire to make sure that since they're going to be getting lots of recommendations from a number of different work groups, if they've had a chance to review, they have a chance to have some input, rather than sort of being in a position, which probably you all appreciate, of sort of a take it or leave it and rubber stamp the recommendations. So we anticipate we may get some comments back from full MRT members, at which point we would sort of take it back to this group, and then again try to sort of finalize everything if we can by November 1st. I think that's going to be a challenging time frame to meet, but that's going to be our goal. The meeting in which the full MRT considers formally the recommendations is December 13th. We get you now to an open meeting, so any of you are interested can go to that meeting. And at that time, the recommendations and the report will be presented to them in the Medicaid redesign team. Should also mention that the report and so on, once we've had a chance to kind of finalize it, will also be made public and be on the website as all the materials that we've done to date. So that's the process. So you can anticipate that after this meeting, you know, there may be lots of email back and forth and trying to get your final comments and nods that this is something that you want to put on the full MRT, and then there may be some back and forth. If it's minor sort of editing things, then we might just deal with that. If there are more substantial issues related to recommendations or discussion, then we may need to, I don't think we'll need to have another meeting, but I think we might, you know, have a conference call or something like that. We'll see what kind of comments we get. That's the process. Do you have anything?
No, the work groups are really coalescing, and if you haven't had a chance to go to the MRT work website, there are two groups that have already finished their recommendations, and their reports are up on the web. So if you want to see what a final report looks like before ours gets done, that's your opportunity. But it's really impressive the broad scope of what's being addressed in all of these committees. And I'm confident, seeing what's already been done and what we've done in this group, that by the end, by November, we're going to have an amazing package that's taken the deep dive beyond what we were able to do in the compressed time period for MRT Phase 1. This phase is really setting the groundwork for reshaping Medicaid for the future in ways that we're really going to be leading the pack again in terms of what we can do with Medicaid in New York State and then serve as a model for the rest of this country. So thank you again in advance for all of your work and your time. It is important. We value your time. We take it very seriously. And these recommendations, they're really good because of your work. Thank you.
Two other sort of things I just addressed. I was asked about whether this group continues after this. You know, for those of you that love doing this, and the disappointing answer is no. For those of you that are ready to go back to your civilian life, you should be happy about that. But we did not contemplate that this group, as it's currently configured, would be the group that's proposed in the document around the process going forward, which is not to say that it might not look like this, that it might not even be some of you as individuals. But there was no, as we constructed this, there was no implication that this would be the group. Although clearly, when you look at the document, we're looking for a group with, you know, a balance in terms of membership. Experts, as I've said, I think in the email, experts broadly speaking, so, you know, certainly includes clinical experts, experts in evidence, and, you know, we can think out loud about what, you know, what some of the other kinds of expertise we might need as we go forward. Some of it we might need ad hoc expertise, but the process document does envision that there be an external group much like this that, you know, would help us struggle with sort of the overall benefit package as well as deal with specific components much like we've done today. Closer to the ground, 12:30 is when we're thinking about lunch. If you haven't either brought lunch or paid for lunch out there, there's somebody who will take your money and you can order something and we'll get some food. Why don't we just get started with documents. I made some copies in case people didn't have them. I don't know if there's still any there of both the principles and the process. Again, just to remind everyone, really, you know, we have, in addition to the overall report, we really have three products of our deliberations that we're going to be putting forward to the Medicaid redesign team. A document about principles for benefit design, a document about how we go about making decisions and process we would use going forward after this group is done. And then lastly, if the group wants to, a consideration of specific benefit proposals as we sort of teed up last time. We'll be talking about those in some detail. So why don't we start with the principal document. Anybody not have it? And I'm hoping that too much. That you've got enough to this responsive. I think there's an ongoing issue, and maybe Shalama, you may be able to refresh my memory about with the concerns that was raised by the state about exception process and so on. And I can't remember whether that was something that they were proposing to put in the process document or in the principles. But I think many of all of you, most of you probably still have emails. Some of that experience. So of the things that are not in the document, just in terms of full transparency, that issue is still up for discussion, as well as discussion about whether, in fact, for the group, as we talk about the process, whether we want to name participants from that group or not, or in general. So starting with the principles, are there any comments or concerns, suggestions?
Well, I mean, you had broached the subject with regards to discrimination, defining discrimination, right? Wasn't that an issue that we talked about and you brought up whether or not we have to make sure that we're not discriminating and identifying processes going forward that we make sure that there's no at-risk population? Is that a concern of yours? No, unless I misread you.
Something other than what's in the first bullet, or
yeah. Well, no. How it's defined, how the at-risk subgroups are defined. I thought there was some concern that you expressed based on what I don't know, but I thought there was some group that was pushing for making sure going forward that we're identifying all the at-risk subpopulations within the Medicaid population, that they're not being left out.
The rare disease exceptions, perhaps?
Perhaps that was what it was about.
Well, I think there was a consensus that rather than try to name every group that might be discriminated against and just leaving some group out, that we would just stay broad all Medicaid members.
Okay.
I'm not sure which of two things you're talking about, David. We did have a conversation about that first line around discrimination, whether we should put it, as Peter's suggesting,
specific.
All the different potential groups and so on. I think group consensus was not good down that road. I don't know whether you're also referring to what I described in the comment from Elizabeth, which is concern about an exception process where the evidence may not be available or whatever. But
that's that
rare disease
and
so on. Is that what you're referring to?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that, again, that hangs out there, I think, as a suggestion that we do not, that isn't here with the exclusion of the fourth to last paragraph tries to reflect this with saying that I've literally never been a prisoner required individualized approach, including those standard rare emerging clinical conditions with high levels of prognosis, we know standard care exists and our complex emergency circumstances.
I think that covers it. We thought through that the last time.
I think they had suggested some language in the email from this morning.
I'm looking at that email right now. It says, some conditions or individual benefit decisions may require a modification of rules of evidence or usual review process. In individual cases where a benefit may be medically necessary or appropriate, e.g. rare diseases or exceptional situations, coverage decisions may be modified by a medical review team or other appropriate entity in the department. And I think the concern with that was that we have this language in there. We don't want to set up another parallel appeals process. No staff, no. Everything could open the floodgates if we want to. But we do recognize that there are opportunities for this, and that's what was covered under this. It doesn't go and specify that we need a full review board or how we're going to do it, just that there is a door open for this process to occur.
Right. I'm reading that email, and I think she was looking to try to put this into the process as opposed to the principal document.
Yeah.
Right. Is where she wanted it to be.
And I think we discussed that as well.
Right.
Does it need to be in both versus one?
Right.
So just stick to the principal document then. Is there anything in the principles document that constantly concerns about? I've left the track changes on there this time just to confuse.
that we would want to say something in the process document only because it's part of a process versus,
let's,
I mean, it is
well,
a
let's
principle.
Sign off on this. Let's sign off on the principle.
Okay.
Any other edits to the principle document? Seeing none? Thank you. Let's go to the process. Sorry.
So I was just saying that we should have something in the process that allows for the review of exceptions only because it is a process. So as you're going through this, maybe not everybody always looks at the principles, but they do look at the process. And so there has to be a statement of some sort that allows for exceptions to be looked at.
My concern was that in individual cases where a benefit may be medically necessary or appropriate. Medically necessary or appropriate, again, by what criteria? By a random doctor wants to prescribe some random med to some random patient, that's not medically necessary or appropriate. And this opens up too broadly, the exception.
The other thing that, you know, again, I tried to maybe fail to articulate from the email is that that issue, as I see it, is an individual medical necessity decision process, not one of making overall benefit design decisions about whether a certain benefit comes into the benefit package or not. And there is a process to do that, both for us and also for plans. And there is also a process for compassionate use of non-FDA-approved pharmaceuticals and treatments and so on in individual cases. It doesn't upend in any fashion. So my concern was sort of mixing kind of benefit decisions that are for population, making those decisions, those with their highly individualized process that remains in place. In the note that Elizabeth sent, she raises concerns and raises the issue about if there's benefits that are eliminated, you know, if they're statutorily eliminated, then it eliminates the benefit. And she's absolutely right. If the legislature eliminates an optional benefit, there's nothing in the process document or the principle document that's going to upend that. I mean, as I was saying to Peter, we're dealing with that to some degree with the actual formulas in terms of the precision of the language about what's included and what's not included. So if the legislature speaks and says, you know, this benefit as a general matter is not covered, then she's absolutely right. It's not fair hearing. It's not, you can't think it's fair hearing. But I would submit that when and if that happens, there isn't anything that this document or this process could change about that.
And there is the external appeals process that deals with the rare condition issue that she raised.
Right.
So could you not maybe make a statement that refers back to that? To the exception policy as it exists under the medical review.
It's already in law. I mean, it's in state law.
Yeah. Just so that anyone reading this could understand that exception, there is a process for processing exceptions that can be found wherever. Just so that there's something in the document that deals with the notion of exception, even though you are talking about a benefit and not an individual.
Well, I think it would be not hard to put a statement in there that said that the actual appeal process and the fair hearing process remains intact. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, just something so that there is a way of someone looking at this understanding that there is a process given a benefit for individual cases to be looked at.
I don't know
if they'd be satisfied with that.
Stating what's already existing. So I don't have a problem necessarily.
But how do you envision this document being used? Is this something that is going to be distributed, you know, available to the public, something that people will actually see? If that's the case, then I think it probably makes sense to refer to the external field process.
So in the second to last paragraph, under final determinations along with the rationale for decision for coverage will be made publicly available. Perhaps follow that by the phrase or sentence, the existing external appeal process
is also available.
Is also available.
Or remains to remain in place.
There you go.
Shall not be abrogated.
I think it's important because hopefully this outlives us and somebody will look at it and say where they need to make room for how to deal with possible exemptions.
Okay. Yeah, and they can't, I don't think they're on the phone, so they can't speak to whether it's
yeah, they're not.
We'll tell them to loan them.
Then we have to edit again.
Any other thoughts or comments on process documents?
Yes, I have a thought that I'd like to put forward for consideration. Currently, the document reads, following review, recommendations from all the clinical staff agencies now printed it over, the different standards as follows. No coverage, limited coverage, coverage without limitation, or deferred due to insufficient information. And what I would like to put forth in consideration is whether there should be another category based on the possibility of adjusting the amount of cost sharing that is there. The reason why I put that forward is because even though cost sharing right now is not important in Medicaid in New York, in the future it might become more important, and it would be nice not to shut that door inadvertently with this document. And so, in my view, that is a reason to leave open the possibility that in the future we might want to not have any cost sharing for services which are high value and potentially have an additional amount for services that we don't think represent high value.
That was important.
Why I probably wasn't making it well.
Well, now I get it.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
I have no objections.
So that would be taking that responsibility away from the legislature. Because right now, that's the goal of statute, pretty much. And federal rules really limit the amount of cost sharing.
I guess my question is, what do you mean by cost sharing?
Co-payments and applicability of deductibles.
Well, I don't think it's deductibles right now within Medicaid. Issue you run into with co-payments is the way it's set up. If someone says that they cannot afford it, you still have to provide the service. So essentially, you're like,
right, I do understand that, but my thinking is not in terms of how things are right now. It's thinking about the possibility of future changes in which it may become a more important modulator of utilization.
Well, I would then I propose here and now, it really has no practicality per se, and the person that gets hit is going to be the provider.
And I would
so
agree.
If someone, if I come into you and say, I want to have this procedure done, but Medicaid put on a huge copayment or whatever, but I can't afford the copayment, you're going to need it.
And that is a federal rule, so we
right.
don't have any ability to change
that. So
that
makes it really difficult. I mean, that's the practicality of it. So, I mean, I recommend that that be discussed if and when we do get to that level of consideration that things do come out. But put it in here now, I don't know whether it really has any true meaning and any real practicality. I mean, that's what I'm concerned with. Because I hear it from the provider side, like all the pharmacists, they need the co-payments for the drugs.
Right. Now, will it be complicated to revise this document in the future in the event of that?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we can deal with it. This quarterly group that meets should, as our culture changes and our values change over time, revisit the principles regularly and say, yes, this still pertains to us, or we want to make the following changes. Because I'm sure, I mean, this is very good. I'm sure it's still not perfect, and we will understand other tools in our toolbox may come out, other policy decisions may come from above or below, and this will have to change. So,
okay. Could that be added in, however, into just under limited coverage? You give a bunch of different types of thoughts as to what limited coverage could be. You just put, instead of prior authorization for a retrospective, you put another one in, cost sharing. So it's not another bullet point, but it's part of how a coverage could be limited, since we do identify a number of different types of limitations there. It's not making a whole new category. It's just clarifying another potential. That might meet your needs.
That sounds very sensible to me. I'm not sure.
But it's not changing,
yeah,
particularly the flavor of the document. It's just identifying another potential.
I would suggest not putting it in until such time that it's needed or allowable. Or I just think I agree. The provider eats all of these cost-sharing arrangements.
I also agree. I think it's a very slippery slope. I think that could open up a whole set of problems that providers have to deal with and be unprepared.
I'd like, Foster, can you give a sentence or two about that value-based study that you're going to be doing soon with the intent,
So we got a grant to look at through CMS. It's a $10 million grant, $2 million a year over 5 years to study the impact of patient incentives. It's all on the positive side, not on the negative side, to promote healthy behaviors in really three basic areas: tobacco cessation and participation in tobacco cessation, interventions, hypertension, control, compliant adherence to medications, other behavioral interventions, and the third, two pieces of the diabetes interventions. One is the YMCA program for pre-diabetes and encouraging participation. And you may have seen in the previous document a proposal around that as a benefit. And then second is increasing participation in the benefit that exists currently around certified diabetes educators and having diabetics come in for all the preventive, secondary prevention activities. So we're partnering, as Shaw said, with the University of Pennsylvania to sort of do the evaluation as well as help us with the design so we can look at to what degree do providing incentives. And these are still relatively modest incentives in some cases, paying for the particular service. Cases where we already have a covered benefit, it's making some incentive payment based on both participation and also to some degree on outcomes as well, and trying to test which, you know, how much and at what point in the process, and, you know, which kinds of rewards are useful.
I wanted everyone to know, because as we think in the future of different models of delivery and care and incentives, there are going to be different levers we will have available to us, even in the very near future. And so I think what I'm getting, I hear two things. I hear that it's important that we don't shut the door on such things. On the other hand, it's unworkable in the current system because it only means one thing, and that one thing is bad for providers. And so to the extent that until that bad for providers element goes away or changes, we shouldn't even broach it. In the current document, unless we're very explicit about the narrow bounds of what our purposes are, and that may be a little too wordy for something along these lines. Considering this is a living document, I would propose that we just table it for now and think about it in the future. Okay. Good. Any other thoughts or comments on this document?
So again, the edit I'll make will be the line we talked about in terms of referencing existing external dealing and their process with the end of the process document and considering the model.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Good luck.
So first, you know, I have to say thank you to a lot of people who've been working furiously since the last meeting and into the night, in early morning, to put these proposals together. It turns out, you know, trying to sort out all of the evidence, apply it, and create the specific benefit, and get the numbers right, it's challenging even for a limited number of proposals we have. We have 11 proposals that we're going to be considering. So I think all the people who are working first here in this room, you know who you are, and thank you all. The other thing to say is that we did as best we could with the numbers here in terms of fiscal projections. I don't think any of us would say that this is necessarily the final answer. As you'll see, in some of these, the projections have lots of assumptions, as on occasion financial projections do. You know, there are certain things that are not always clearly knowable, such as to what degree do the benefits get, is there uptake in a particular eventually benefit. And to the degree that we had any kind of existing evidence based on that, either previous experience or otherwise, we try to fill it in, but in some cases it really is not much more than a best guess at what kind of uptake we would see. And obviously, the uptake of a benefit has huge implications in terms of what the costs are as well as what the potential savings are. On the savings side, I think we try to be as conservative as we could be in making these. I mean, I think we're all capable of making wild, you know what, projections about how much money we're going to save, and probably all familiar with, you know, that's sort of the MO when you want something covered is to make all sorts of projections. And again, we tried our best to stick with the evidence as we saw that it would apply to our program population in New York. And I think the good news is that for some of these, we have some experience with some of these benefits, either in pilots or demonstrations that we can build on. Whether those suppositions work out on a statewide basis, again, sort of up for grabs. I'll also say that while we had some desire to try to fit the evidence with the typology that's in the principles, we didn't really get there. So we described to some degree what the evidence is. Some of these have references, but we were not able to do a sort of one-for-one and say, this is type 1 evidence, type 2 evidence, type 3 evidence. That's, I think, where we want to go to going forward as we review proposals, but we did what we could in the time frame that we had. So many of you also around this table were extremely helpful. We had a lot of help from Mark, from Ed, in reviewing some of these proposals, from David. We gave New York City Health Department some work to do in helping us with these proposals, as well as our Bureau of Chronic Disease for the lactation consultants and obesity and so on, and smoking tobacco control program. So we got a lot of assistance from lots of us in trying to put this together. So
I think the only thing I would add is remember what these are. This is not the final way that it's going to be actually effectuated. As long as we get all the main principles in this document, you know, we don't need the expose on the background information or the evidence. We need to make sure that the key points from our discussion are well represented in this document so that when we go and make these real, we have enough guidance to do it. You know, you don't need to specify to the nth degree what is covered or not. We'll figure that out. We do need to get the broad brushstroke show. And so it's that balance that you have to strive for in today's discussion as well. Dive deeply enough, but not micromanage.
Before we get started on the initial proposal, does anybody have any questions about the process or what this is or what we're asking you to do? Great. So I want to start with something easy. What's easy here, Greg? Is the dietary easy?
Maybe. Sure.
So, these don't have numbers, but they do have names. There's the name of this one that expanded podiatry coverage, which also took me to 5 years.
Since it just came off of the oven about 20 minutes ago, we might as well keep it warm and talk about it.
Does everyone have copies of all of them, or you think you do? If you do, then what I'm going to suggest is that we have some extras back here. I'd like to open them up to the folks in the audience as well. So maybe someone from staff can come and take them to the back if that's all right.
Sure. I see 10 piles. There should be 11. So I don't know if there's a pile sitting on that.
Dietary. Everybody has the dietary history that came up late. Okay.
Maybe one of the staff members can come help and distribute them to the copies to the group and
give it out.
Henry, are you still on the phone?
Sure am, but I realized that when you were talking about these specific benefit reviews, I don't think I have them. I had the original document agenda with the revised principles, but not all the documents laid together in the way Foster described.
They should be coming to you very shortly. We were putting them all together and emailing them when I left a little while ago.
Fine, I'll look for it.
And it's Arnold Saperstein. I'm on the phone, too, if you can send it to me also.
We're going to send them to everybody, and hopefully they'll be there shortly. And I'm checking on that right now.
Yeah, I don't see it yet, so that means probably not yet. But we'll get to it within 10 minutes, I hope.
And in the meantime, we'll just be very specific about what we're looking at.
Okay, so why don't we just start with podiatry?
So just to lay the groundwork, we had some conversation about this previously. Right now, the current benefit excludes private practitioner podiatry for adults in fee-for-service. What we heard yesterday and heard in other forums is that for folks that are in health plans, they do not have that restriction. So currently, if you're in a health plan, covered in the Medicaid Managed Care plan, you have access to podiatry both in clinic settings as well as in private practice. What this proposal would do is to sort of equalize that, if you will, to create for Medicaid fee-for-service as well a benefit that goes that adds to the ability to be seen by a podiatrist in the clinic to be seen in practice as well. And this is for adults that we're talking about. So we, I think, try to present forward, and hopefully this is new information to most of you, for the specific benefits related to podiatry care. I think that there's a general appreciation of good evidence about the role of foot care and examination of the foot to prevent foot ulcers and complications related to those. Less clear, and we did have a chance to talk to the Podiatry Association actually right before we met last time about this, knowing exactly what the frequency of this should be, and exactly what procedures should be done and what's most medically necessary and so on for individual diabetics. The very, the science around that is less clear. But there's general agreement, I think, about the value of at least a one visit per year for folks that have diabetes. And that's part of what we base the proposal on in terms of both fiscal as well as potential cost savings. As you can see, we are fairly modest in terms of thinking about what the cost savings would be. Less than $1 million, about $660,000. These are trying to look at relatively short savings over the next few years. There's some evidence that if you look over a longer period of time, the savings may be greater. But again, we try to be relatively conservative in thinking about what the estimates would be in terms of savings.
I think also that it's conservative because the only savings that we took here were on amputation reduction.
Right.
We didn't take other kinds of preventive savings. And I think, as with all of these numbers, we're open to input and we can perfect this as we go through. I mean, the podiatrists may have a reaction to the E&Ms we chose and so forth. And with a little more time, we could probably get into a little bit more precision.
I don't have a problem with the proposal, but I'm just wondering, do we have any evidence that because right now adults are limited to receiving the service in clinics, but they're not getting the services?
We do get regularly requests from podiatrists who are serving duals and getting co-insurance to be able to treat fee-for-service patients that come to them that are not duals. So some access. That's why, again, I used a 10% estimate against the whole diabetic as a control for some are getting it in other settings, and some may not show up for care, and to also still predict the kids factor out. But that it's an access issue. We won't know until we go. We used to have relatively decent penetration before we stopped coverage in 1992. Clinics have probably taken up a lot of that space. But good question. I'm not sure we have an accurate answer.
I think
we did
that
because
that indirect stuff, if you look at on diabetes recognition program that NCQA has for physicians in New York State, we've been followed with the New York State Health Foundation that tried to promulgate it. If you look at how the docs do out of the gate the first time that they try to do audit. The foot exam, this is for primary care, is one of the lowest rates that you're going to see out of the 11 metrics. So, and this is across the board for all comers, be they Medicaid, commercially insured folks, Medicare. So I think there is a big an access issue with this, and it's something that's a preventable problem that if you really had it addressed well, and say all the docs who are taking care of people with diabetes, either the cameras, let alone send them to the podiatrist, would be further ahead in terms of getting rid of the PQI that you have with the amputation and all that. So I think that anecdotally, from what I've seen, this was, I guess, one of the two or three metrics that all the docs I tend to fail at by the whole set of 11.
The thing I thought of relative to your question, Kathy, is some of the clinics are not filling as much of any podiatry, suggesting they may not have that specialty on board. So that would, you know, there may be a regional need to lean a little on the private office where there's not a access to specialty.
The other impact that you'll see of this is that you'll probably see an increase in utilization of vascular evaluations and vascular surgery work. Because as you start to look at your diabetics, you start to identify people with at-risk limbs, that'll be the other side of the bubble kind of popping out a little bit.
Good point. Arnie, I know you're on the phone. As our resident endocrinologist, any thoughts?
No, I think it's actually a good idea to add that access to fee-for-service. And clearly I know at HHC, podiatrists, there is access, but there's certainly some access difficulties, and having community providers be able to speak for service patients is actually a good thing.
So is the benefit one visit, or is it just access to service?
I think it sort of yet to be determined, and I think, you know, the time frame may have some struggle with the nuances of what the benefit would be. I think we have some work to do on that. But the I think we put the one visit as sort of an average of what we see as sort of the floor, and maybe others that are medically necessary, visits as well. And so I think we need to work on exactly what the confines are of that. There isn't detail in here to really describe that. What kind of diabetic is it? All diabetics, obviously, gestational diabetics might be in this category. Does it include diet control diabetics? Do they have different, benefit based on their needs versus other folks?
It may be interesting to look at the claims that you do have from the clinic and see what kind, how do you who gets the service, what E&M codes are used, so that you kind of can help guide that decision.
I think one of the most challenging things in terms of going from evidence to benefit is the frequency issue. There's so infrequently good evidence to say 3 is better than 4, 2 is better than 1. And as you might imagine, it's highly individualized. So part of our challenge, I think, we'll have kind of figured that out. First place we go, obviously, would be, is there evidence that suggests what it should be? And again, we look at some of the information that we got presented to us, and I think it's not that particular issue is a little less clear. There are certainly recommendations and guidelines. But the evidence behind, 3 versus 4 versus 2, again, as you would imagine, highly individualized.
But our role is to say 1 is better than 0, and
that's clearly
kind of open the door.
Open the door.
Well, and the other side is, I recall when this was first implemented, it was because of abuse. It wasn't,
The question will be is, are you really looking at preventative, or are you looking at treatment? Because preventative visit is a one maybe type of visit. The treatment, you throw a nailed debridement in here. People are in 9 or 10 weeks that the podiatrist having nailed debridement done. So that's a very different access issue. So if this is designed to be a preventative or amputation type of issue, that's a different issue than a treatment issue. So you have to decide, which are we doing right now?
Also, are you expecting this to just offload the clinics? Or to actually increase utilization? Is there a proposed cost, or you're looking to define what you're actually going to cover before you can define the cost?
There's a proposed cost in the proposal, and just a commercial for those on the phone, just should have an email that came in from my assistant, Tina Keenan, that has all of the proposals. The one for podiatry, unfortunately, because of computer issues, has a weird name. Starts with ATT. So if you find the one that says ACT, that's a podiatry proposal. And right now what we just did is we said that if you took an average E&M and nails agreement of $62 and we spread that out at one visit per person against the fee-for-service population, it said 10% of folks would get that one visit. Again, I think we're thinking we would drive up access. There may be some access replacement, but I think this would probably be more for a fee-for-service person that doesn't have access to the dietary services, is trying to chase that down through the physician in the clinic would be able to get it from the dietist on a fee-for-service basis. I think it would square up what's available in the managed care benefit. We are not, in this proposal, specifically limiting it right now in preventive services. We could, although that's kind of hard to do, as you know, through coding.
I don't know why you'd want to go just preventive, because if you don't treat, you end up with amputations and much higher cost. You're gonna, it won't be podiatry; it'll be orthopedics and other and vascular surgery. So why would you want to limit the benefit just to preventive? It doesn't even make sense.
And I think we have a little bit more bandwidth now to be looking at outlier provider volume issues now than we used to. So
I think you're right. I think it's a different era. We're not worried about fraud and abuse as much as we are about getting the needed services out there, and we have other tools to look at fraud.
But then again, right.
Here's how we come to all the services for the providers. If you only have one visit, well, what if they find something? So now what do you do? Or who do they go see? I think that starts a whole other problem. Medical legal issues there, too. So they started as an early officer, but I can only see the diagnosis once. So then they go along, and then they get amputated eventually anyway. So if logic, I tell you why it sounds foolish.
I think you have to actually support it in its entirety, but I think your cost estimates will be off then, because I think it's going to be more than one visit, because these people will be cycled in every 10 or 11 weeks to have something done with nail debridement.
But there will be other folks who don't get anything.
That's
a lot of
them.
So
for what it's worth, in the commercial world, the way they handle this, there's certain categories of providers to which apply what's called freedom of choice provisions, and podiatrist is one of them that says podiatrists can treat patients for a covered benefit under their policy that they can be treated by a physician. So it doesn't say one preventive, or if there's a medically necessary service in your contract that you can get care from a physician or a nurse practitioner or whatever, you can get it from a podiatrist.
Okay.
Only other comment I had is it may be helpful for you internally to figure out how you're going back to our very first meeting, how you're going to evaluate the finance, like what did this really do financially to the system?
Yeah, so what we do, and that's a great comment, and so what we're doing now with each of the MRT proposals is we line up the staff person with our new Salient tool, and they have to put together a fiscal model to look at what kinds of curves we're trying to bend and to sort of pre-study that. Some of these get tough in terms of selecting control and comparison and all that, but we will actively be tracking what our uptake rates are, what they look like regionally, and if there's any reduction in ulcerations or amputations, we could, you know, to the extent that our data would tell us that, we could look at that. We could also start looking at, you know, one physician is doing 100 services.
So as it currently reads, this proposal says, under this proposal, Medicaid should permit adult Medicaid recipients who have a diagnosis of diabetes mellitus to obtain care from a private practicing podiatrist. It doesn't specify preventive versus therapeutic. It's general. It's fine. We understood that the principle is broader coverage, and we'll go with that. Any other changes or thoughts on this proposal? Okay, good. Great discussion. Let's move on.
Yes, or will we vote later, or is it a head nod?
I think it's a head nod that said yes, but I'm only able to move it back.
Second.
So just kicking with things that I think are easier. How about that? We'll work our way up. Osteoarthritis of the knee. limited coverage of arthroscopic kidney surgery for osteoarthritis. And just, again, I think we talked about this briefly last time, and got some help on this one from Mark and from Arvin, but, you know, the evidence as well as the guidelines recommend against arthroscopy, simply for osteoarthritis. That certainly becomes sort of an implementation issue, which is how clearly do we know what the diagnosis is and what the reason is for getting arthroscopy. So, other diagnoses are legitimate, get into coding issues and so on, but as it stands right now, it would be a policy which would not have any kind of pre-authorizations to it. This would be both prospective in terms of driving coverage policy as well as retrospective in terms of any types of reviews that might be done. Individuals that only had osteoarthritis. This is a fairly modest financial and I guess that's a, sort of a good news story. In fact, when we look at the data, that we see very little of this being done specifically for osteoarthritis alone. Greg, refresh my memory. This was looking, this fiscal was looking at the people service managed care.
Yes, it was. Okay. And again, I think, you know, when we look at Medicaid, we very often see fewer procedures because this would not include the dual. It would be co-insuring, and a lot of the utilization might have been in the dual population. So we tend to be a very medical-leaning program as opposed to Medicare, where you see more procedures popping up.
So then would this not be covered under the dual system?
That's an interesting question. What we've been doing on co-insurance is we've been trying to line up our policies in terms of what we pay for. Historically, if Medicare paid for it, we would co-insure it. And this year's budget implemented a proposal to line up our co-insurance policy so that if we didn't cover something in Medicaid, we would not co-insure it. Or if the Medicaid rate were lower than the Medicaid rate in certain settings, we would lower it. So we could look at trying to line up our co-insurance. Some of these, we would have data issues in terms of what was coming over on the Medicare claim. That would potentially increase the impact of it if, and I'm not smart on this, Medicare is paying for a lot of this. Guessing they are.
On the co-insurance, you're still paying 20% of the 20%.
Well, 20% of the 20% is for the physician. Not for the clinic. So that would include the physician component of this. We would limit our 20% of 20% to whatever our, you know, gross spend was. So in this case, if there was a procedure for which evidence did not recommend that we cover, we would pay nothing. We pay zero of the 20%. And again, we'd have to do a little research as to whether or not we can actually do that with the RAP claim we get from Medicare.
Do we know if commercial plans pay for this benefit?
Probably more than Medicare.
I think this was a question on my board recertification on Monday, and I think I got it right because I read it. So.
That's the best I won.
Huge. Yes, got
it. My comment is about evidence. So I understand that there wasn't sufficient time to do in-depth analyses of evidence and categorization in the 2 weeks since our last meeting. But I'm concerned about the precedent of saying that we won't cover something without mentioning evidence even once in the whole document. So I'm wondering if we should just have a line saying there is evidence that there is no benefit. Something to that effect.
It says that right here.
The last sentence.
Yeah. Where?
The last sentence of the proposal description that says Dr. Strasser's debridement of the osteoarthritic knee is no more effective than sham surgery and physical and medical therapy. I mean, we could go into
a citation.
Yeah.
There's also the second paragraph on the proposal description, the AAOS guidelines recommend against performing arthroscopy as a primary diagnosis for the OA of the knee. There is evidence that removal of loose debris has no functional benefit.
Right. Then I would suggest making it clearer, because I would argue that the current language is unclear, number one, because many professional society-based guidelines are not necessarily evidence-based, and it's a mistake for us to assume that just because a guideline, a professional society guideline argues in favor or against something, that it is evidence-based, and we shouldn't do that either. And secondly, rather than saying there's evidence that removal of loose debris, et cetera, we should more simply say there is evidence that arthroscopic knee surgery results in minimal pain relief and no functional benefit in patients that have joint space narrowing. That way it's clearer.
Sure. We can do that. We can do that and pick up the two sites and other proposals we've more directly picked the sites up. Right, we could do that.
And this one actually probably has a high flow. In our typology, has a high flow. This is type 2 evidence. This is one well-designed randomized controlled trial, right?
Right. With sham surgery.
With sham surgery.
So we could just put in type 2 cell level that way.
And absolutely right. That professional guidelines are related with seconds as well as level of randomized.
Other comments? Good. All in favor? Aye. All those against? No? Okay, let's move on.
With that, we're going to go back and look at the dual stuff.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and I think we'd go back and look at the dual for all of these because our policy is that we should create no payment where we're not covering. And then also we would have already implemented if there's a rate differential, we'd also try to ceiling our call insurance to that. The total payment with call insurance to that rate is one of both of those.
So as long as we're making the orthopedic surgeons happy, why don't we finish the next one about treatment of low back pain? We face the treatment of low back pain for those interventions without compelling evidence. So this one, you mentioned we have discretion about this last time, that this doesn't take away any interventions that have an evidence base. So it's not taking away therapy, it's not taking away recommendations for exercise, for limited rest, or any of the things, including surgery where it's indicated. So this is specifically trying to not take those interventions around which the evidence is either non-consistent or limited. If there's any benefit, in some cases, there's some evidence of harm. So I take from our description here that it is likely that we were not able to specifically note many of these therapies specifically, Greg. We sort of have a general financial impact of $7.7 million, and I'm not sure how much of that relates to these specific therapies.
This is going to be tough. I mean, some of these codes we don't cover, so there wouldn't be savings because we're not covering them. Again, on the fee-for-service side, we'd have to go back into encounter data, which we just didn't have the time to do, to see if some of them are covered by plan. But I think that our savings would be somewhat less than the 7.7, and it would depend on the uptake of those procedures.
Right.
We just didn't get there in the time.
I'm wondering first, for you, Joe, and do you have any comments about them, or for Bill, do you have any comments about these specific therapies and whether you cover them currently, whether for Medicaid, Excellus, or...
What we've gone through is, I will base our decision on is the Blue Cross and Blue Shield program that they have with kind and pretty expensive. This has been kind of vetted with all the literature and all the evidence. So we haven't covered any of
it. And I just say also that the 7.7 are the procedures to treat low back pain. We really did not lay out here yet systemic corticosteroids.
medication, things like that. So the potential savings with implementation could be, you know, the potential range of dollars that could be recouped could be larger because we just were looking at procedures here. But again, a lot of it is going to get to the plans because I'm guessing a lot of those dollars were planned on.
I'd like to raise the question of whether we should divide this into two separate recommendations. So one recommendation concerning those treatments for which evidence suggests there's no benefit, and then another recommendation for which there's insufficient evidence. Just because the category of procedures for which evidence suggests that there's no benefit is much more of a slam dunk. I think in our last meeting, I forget, somebody brought up the issue of, if we don't do things for people with back pain, what do we do? While I don't necessarily believe in that argument myself, I think it's much more possible to raise that argument towards a broader category of low back pain services without compelling evidence and for the particular services for which evidence suggests no benefit.
I think Scott raises a really interesting question. I think part of that is sort of a command decision on the part of the department in the way in which it wants to approach the burden of proof. Because if you say there's no evidence of benefit, say there's evidence that there's no benefit, that is a slam dunk. If you say there's no evidence of benefit, then you still have an opening where folks can come in and say, well, just because there's no evidence of benefit, it's not going to help that one person. Provide access to that because it may help them. There's no evidence that it won't help them. And so it's almost as if this becomes important if you want to leave that door open. If you want to close that door and say, we're going to require this burden of proof be met before we consider these things, then it becomes the distinction becomes less important, although it can be noted in the write-up, and it becomes a much stronger write-up. Where you set the bar is important.
I mean, I think that we have to be mindful. I saw that came out yesterday in the Commonwealth comparing, you know, where the United States is in terms of health outcomes for electricity points, where we are on spending, and think about the overall, you know, exercise of MRT and our budget situation and say, can we really afford as a state and a public program to pay for things that have no evidence, when we have things that have evidence that we're sitting around the table trying to figure out how we can cover. I don't know, but I think it is an issue. I think
it's a challenge. Also, yesterday, Jerome Grootman's opinion piece came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, basically saying that we shouldn't use evidence-based medicine as a mallet in order to prevent clinical judgment from applying. I think we have to be also mindful of those sorts of concerns at the same time that we're mindful of the tremendous inefficiency of our system because we pay for lots of useless services.
You know, how about this?
This document really does allow for a very wide range of evidence to quote everything from academic consultants to primary source documents that control the red line.
Say this, that what our read of this proposal and the reason we left the authorization that the committee would give the department under this, it would limit or exclude coverage of and then list things. So it, and then I think what it does is it would default back to the process and the principles that we've all agreed we would utilize to continuously review evidence against coverage decisions. So, for instance, if new evidence emerges that suggests that a particular form of low back pain might respond to a particular medicine or a particular injection, we could change that. But this, I think, authorizes us to go in and dig in, probably again with some more assistance from Mark and others, in this issue to try to limit our payment for non-efficacious procedures for low back pain. So, I was hopeful that you would give us this broad authority to go forward and just implement this with the principles and the process we described.
How about this? I mean, I think there's value to a halfway solution, and that might be just stating explicitly in the proposal the different levels of evidence for the different types of therapy that we're asking to no longer cover. So that instead of having multiple proposals on back pain, one back pain proposal where we specify there is no evidence for blank. There is evidence of no benefit for the model. And that way we get both the principle of being evidence-based in here and understanding it and being explicit about what evidence is there is right up here, but at the same time keeping things simple for us.
I wanted to raise another concern with the recommendations, which may be an increased use of pain medication.
Yeah, this is Henry chiming in. I mean, I would simply say that if anything, there is probably equivalent data that shows that these kinds of things don't mitigate pain medicine requirements in the long term. I think that unfortunately all of the treatments listed here that the state has provided all provide essentially short-term benefit and does not mitigate, unfortunately, the request or demand from patients for pain medications. I do want to chime in just a bit, though, and just say that I agree with Dr. Shah's. I think that was Dr. Shah saying sort of looking at each one separately, and also the way this is written in terms of either limit or exclude, it leaves a lot open to interpretation. Because I think there are, you know, in terms of the specific procedures, you could make an argument that for some you would want to limit. In other words, you would utilize perhaps some of these if, you know, you've already had, you know, previous physical therapy or multiple trials of physical therapy, you know, that kind of thing, versus an outright exclusion, say, for something like prolotherapy. So I think being a little bit more specific would serve us well because this is an important area of opportunity and, quite frankly, patient safety. One other thought I had is also just on the side of being positive is that, you know, we should think as a committee, not now but down the road, that there are indeed some trials that indicate that there is good treatments for chronic low back pain. But it does require a true multidisciplinary approach, which includes cognitive behavioral treatments along with supervised pain management and probably some degree of exercise. It's really a multimodal type approach. Those studies are coming out of Europe, and we don't apply those because, you know, our system is incentivized towards doing multiple kinds of procedures like this. So I think we should put down for future review the notion that if we were to do away with these things, we could incentivize perhaps multimodal treatment for people with chronic low back pain, which I think begins to address the issue of the widespread inappropriate use of pain medications.
Thank you. I think that's good. I don't know if that belongs in this document. This is, remember, our goal is to come up with broad principles of the types of things we want to do. This is a patient safety kind of proposal to that end. You know, certainly there are issues around narcotic use that may go up, opioid use that may go up in the short term. But as a broad brushstroke, the kinds of things that I think we should include are specifying the levels of evidence for each one of these and then still allowing us to dial up or dial down exclusion relative to the levels of evidence and understanding that we'll fine-tune it over time, you know, just as we do with other areas.
And one other quick question, just listening to Greg's discussion and explanation of how they want to use this, or you all want to use this in the department, it just struck me that if we are saying, by listing the hierarchy of evidence in the principles, we have said that a single expert or a single case report is evidence. Could we be boxed into a situation in which a single expert becomes the only evidence available? And so we have an evidence recommendation to cover something. So I mean, we got ourselves into a little bit of a pinch there with our being specific in our principles.
I don't see that. I mean, I think if I see it differently, maybe something that needs to be more explicit. I mean, the hierarchy is what it is. It doesn't, in my mind, suggest that anything that hits any of those levels means that you view it in the same way or it's going to
okay. I just, when we say, okay, is this an evidence-based recommendation? and we let single expert or single case report as evidence, and somebody come back to us and say, no, wait a minute, this is evidence-based because we've got, it's the lowest evidence, but there's no evidence that it's not effective, and there is this one case report or this single expert that says it is effective, therefore, I don't know if we, if we got ourselves in a box or not, but I don't think that's what we intended, but...
Well, does that define it as something we have to do or something that becomes a consideration? There's a difference between that.
I just want to pull the lens back a little bit before this process and talk about how we went about making reductions in the program, which was basically look at a big number, take a calculator, and apply it to various sectors and say you got 2%. Now what we have is a level of evidence that lays across a variety of coverage areas, and if we're in a position where we're trying to take dollars out of the system, those levels of evidence would certainly not support our continuing to advance payment in those kinds of areas, I think. So I think what this does is it gives us a prioritized framework to make, I'll just call them more intelligent decisions with regard to what we invest in and what we stop paying for. But because that, I think, would be, we're just trying to get a little bit more nuance with regard to how we manage the program. So I definitely agree with Flush. I don't think any level of evidence can show the coverage.
But I hear the point you're making, but we've not specifically said, I think for good reason, that the cutoff of level of evidence around which
that is
here.
Which is the alternative.
And I think the problem is that that creates a converse level of inflexibility that I think is problematic. But you're not wrong, I think, in pointing out potentially a weakness in what we're trying to do in the process, which is so how will we deliberate around benefits that may have varying levels of the type of evidence. And again, we implied it, but we haven't said it explicitly, that the higher level of evidence, there's more weight given to a higher level of evidence.
Right.
I just put it that way.
Yes, but on the other hand, a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial that results in $1 million per patient per year times 100,000 patients is not going to be covered by Medicaid. So even where the evidence is there, there's going to be discretion. And I think that the frame change is what's most important. Is that we are considering evidence and that we have some thought to the levels of evidence. There isn't yet an external process that we can prescribe to or use as a template on grading the levels of evidence versus population health benefits versus costs, which is ultimately what we would need to get to that level of detail. And short of that, let's at least move in the right direction. And we'll have those cases where we have the case report, and we'll have to make some tough decisions, and some of them may be political as well. Good. This is great discussion. I just want to keep us on time because we have a lot to consider. So unless there are significant substantive changes to this, can I suggest we move on? Any last comments on this proposal? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Let's move on.
We'll add the level of evidence.
So my suggestion is we've got a certified lactation consultant. We probably put it back to me. And this proposal came from several quarters. Based on, as we talked about before, I think the group talked about all level A, B, recommended U.S. Preventive Task Force services should be covered. This is one of the few in that category that is currently not specifically covered, which is organized structured breastfeeding support. This specific recommendation, again, tries to take from the broader language of the U.S. Preventive Task Force and convert it into a benefit. And the specific benefit that this covers is the services of certified lactation consultants. The description talks about the evidence
the guidelines from preferences to guidelines from ACOG that also suggests you know, promotion of breastfeeding. There are in our public health, New York Chronic Disease, based on the literature that they reviewed and their analysis, suggests that there's cost savings, potentially up to 532, I think, as I read it, is probably the lower end of the range of cost savings, as you might imagine. There is a range. And again, reflecting the comment I made earlier, we picked the most conservative estimate that we had from decreasing instances of Tysmedia, gastroenteritis, necrotizing enterocolitis, colitis. There are also other potential savings related to obesity, which I don't think we necessarily have it here specifically. The cost, we estimated about $240 per birth, and I see some of the calculations there based on a number of births, suggesting an average of 3 visits with a church lactation consultant. The back page talks about projected fiscal impact with varying assumptions, 100% utilization, 50 and 25, and then savings are important with that as well. Those numbers are pretty high but on both sides. We know that there is reduced rates relative to disparities, which we've not really talked about with some of the other proposals. But remember, as a lens that we were asked to look at all these proposals with, we know that breastfeeding is lower for in the African-American community compared to the total population. Providing these services potentially might make some dent in their disparities. There are a whole host of benefits to the recommendation. You can see them there, the benefits there. There are some challenges to the implementation of the benefit in that the recommendations are for that happen both prenatally as well as perinatally in the hospital and postpartum. And as you may know, each of those settings has a different cast of characters and different entertainment rules that go along with it, from ATRD or genes for delivery to APGs and potentially different provider settings that may happen. Those are challenges that we don't address in here, and it would clearly be some of our implementation challenges. That's the proposal. There are listing here other issues that we might need to deal with relative to licensing issues. There certainly is are issues relative to the number of certified lactation consultants that are available that would like to be a break on this. If we're contemplating specific payment for this, which I think we are, then there are potentially some issues related to what types of individuals, based on scope of practice, can provide the service in the home or in the setting as well. Most of the certified lactation consultants right now are in have RNs or LPNs and so on, but there are a whole host of folks that offer lactation consultant services that don't specifically have that professional degree. And how that would play out in terms of both access and payment issues and scope of practice, I think we need to be put through. That's the proposal. Any questions about this?
So I have a question, and it's expressed here as a concern with the WIC program. How do you see those two coming together, or do you see this being a service that can be reimbursed within WIC programs? Or it just seems like that you have to be really clear about how this, because people in WIC program really promote breastfeeding. And we, for example, have a breastfeeding center, so women within the community are able to come in and breastfeed in a comfortable environment. We have our workers being able to pump their milk, and they get the counseling. So are those services reimbursable, or are they only reimbursable if they're done in our clinical setting? And do they need to be reimbursable in WIC, since WIC grant funds kind of are there for that?
Great question. I don't know the answer.
That's really something to think about.
Yeah. And we've had this same issue with formula and coverage in Medicaid, availability in WIC. There's financing issues in terms of where does that federal benefit come into the state. So we would certainly look at that, and that's why we're kind of calling it out.
Okay. I think another concern would be, so someone gives birth and they get a session in the hospital. And then what we have found is that women do breastfeed, but not as long as we would like them to. So at what point is it okay to engage another lactation consultant so that we kind of encourage women to prolong their breastfeeding?
Question. This is Henry. I have a question. Foster, in the calculations for the net savings, what were the assumptions? Are you assuming that the, you know, providing the service yields 100%, you know, response, if you will, for 6 months of lactation? I'm just trying to understand the dollar savings that you're estimating.
So the Office of Public Health basically went in and provided dollar savings of about $532 per infant, and that was related to lowering otitis media, gastroenteritis, and other disease states. And we basically give a range in the paper of if our uptake was $240 of birth for lactation consultation, how much it would, we would spend at 100% down to 25% utilization. And if we took that $532 per infant against that $240 cost, there's a savings per infant now. And then we just do that same basic, you know, 100% down to 25% utilization. There is interaction effect in terms of if we really have real numbers here, we would be looking at the difference between what those rates would be for someone not breastfed, someone breastfed, to look at the incremental cost. We're just looking at the gross dollar value of the spend against the gross dollar value of the savings and then taking rough guesses about uptake. But I think we could collectively say to ourselves that the benefit should outweigh the cost, and that the more women that we get in the program, the more savings that we would produce. And you could argue about the 532, you could argue about the 240, you could argue about the uptake, and all are arguable. But I think we're proposing that this would pay for itself.
So, and Henry, as I look through the write-up, the assumption is that Healthy People 2010 goals would be met coming up. That's where they get the 532. And those specific goals are that 50% of infants would receive any breast milk and 17% would be exclusively breastfed in 6 months.
That's perfect, Foster. That's just what I need to hear. Thank you.
Yeah.
Do we have any sense as to how many certified lactation consultants we have in the state? Like, this is too low.
Right.
That's going to kind of drive what your uptake potential is, because there aren't too many of them, and that's who are going to be reimbursable.
But currently there's 627. I'm sorry, did you ask me that? 627 in New York State. 70% all hold a professional license. Both of them are RNs, nurse midwives, and so on. And then there are also, as I referenced, 1,900, I guess there's more, certified lactation consultants in New York. Because the most hospitals in New York State provide a survey. Right. This is just the backdrop.
But I think that would be part of how you decide how you would want to administer this. You are limited to individuals who have a professional license and have this designation. Are you going to open it up to anybody? Because like, you run into the issues, like I know there's the Lachey League and all that stuff that's out there that I don't think they're necessarily RNs or LPNs, but they know a heck of a lot more about this than most women do. And they're available to women that have that kind of issues and say they are breastfeeding, but then they have to stop for say they had a
radiological study, and if you have medicine, you can't really give the child milk, the breast milk, and all that stuff. So I don't know whether that's included here or not. Mr.
Do you know if the Preventive Task Force recommendation was structured around the certification, or
no? I don't think so. I think the recommendation, again, is just an example where, you know, the language in there is around structured breastfeeding support, without specifically saying, you know, there are five lactation counselors who have this qualification.
patients who treat persons as many times in conjunction with breast cancer study.
So one option I'll just throw out for us to think about, because we ran into this with asthma. We were very progressive in covering asthma, and then we had four people that were certified, and our uptake was incredibly high, is to pay a differential for the certified person versus the non-certified person, and to try to put some language together about relevant training and experience, something we probably could not audit, but would try to build something in.
And then some, periodically, we get into issues for Medicaid is making specific payments to providers around scope of practice. State insurance, as you know, we ran into that with asthma educators as well. So whether we bump into that with this or not, with certified lactation consultants that don't otherwise have a professional license or not, I know, would be something we'd have to explore.
Who certifies them?
The International Board.
Okay, so Ron, your sense of state ed on the scope of practice here, if it's an international certification, are we going to
feel on?
Right, but if we said, I'm not thinking of this as a medical service that would be listed in a scope for any of those practitioners.
These are great questions. I think we'll go back.
But I think it would be good to get this committee's thoughts on that, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, if we can suffer through the swings and arrows of scope of practice, would you like us to potentially create a differential? The only reason I recommend a differential is to recognize the pursuit of the certification and those that have invested in that certification. But if the committee wanted us to forward this recommendation and training and experience that we could somehow work through, we could restructure the proposal.
I think at this level, perhaps just recognizing that we want to do something along those lines is good enough for now. So we do progress. If we try to get into the details, there's just no time to figure out all of that right now. But that some sort of recognition of certification would be a
waiting for the final recommendation.
Is anybody else paying for this? Do we know anything about how it's being done elsewhere, if it is at all?
Chair Salas? Chair Emblem?
We pay for my patient presentation with my consultant and our
certification.
The only other change I would suggest along the lines of Paloma said under the concerns with the recommendation, it says care will need to be taken to ensure there's no duplication of effort. I would insert right there. And careful integration with, strike the word between, Medicaid and other state federal funded programs. So basically recognizing that we want to make sure that people overlap in a sensible way. That hopefully will address some of that.
Just based on the comment that you're covering it for licensed professionals, that is the other option. So we could say certified lactation folks, and then we could say RN. We could say whatever we want the criteria to be, plus relevant training and experience.
Right. The other thing is, your issue which you raised, which is, we can start someplace and then evaluate the essay and modify the time goes on and start with things that we are confident don't raise issues around state ed or other complications, and if the uptake is understanding that we need to modify that over time. So we think the benefit design is being something that could be iterative.
Yeah, my only suggestion was to go to the board of lactation specialists and see what criteria they, qualifications they recommend, and kind of stick to them, because especially in underserved areas, which is where Medicaid patients are, it's hard to find nurses, much less now we're going to have them be like patient consultants. So it may not be that easy to get.
Although the only reason I'm suggesting this is if we said certified you're in, right, but we don't have enough certified and we're looking for something else, one way to avoid the scope of practice and avoid trying to create a standard that we're we're going to have a hard time just to say that we would, if you're not certified but you're a nurse, we would pay for you.
Greg, I think your suggestion is terrific and it puts us closer to being in the spirit of the USPSTF recommendation.
Any other discussion on this?
My only other question was about the financial impact. Aren't most pregnant women enrolled in managed care at this point?
Yes, most are.
So would this not be within the managed care dollars that they get? Right. So is there a real savings to the system? Or is it added money that the managed care plans would get?
We would work that through actuarially, but the goal would be to make this a covered benefit for both the fee-for-service program and for the managed care program. And generally the way it works is when we cover something on the fee-for-service side and we create coverage guidelines, then the plans will usually, as a floor, not necessarily a ceiling, cover to that standard.
Are you asking how you save money in cap-tiered?
Yeah, it seems that everybody's covered under managed care, and they have their capitation rates that they have to manage the care under. Then there may be savings to the plan, but I'm not sure it's to the overall Medicaid.
When they save a whole lot of money, or with all the money they save, then we can reduce the premium.
I'm sure he'll love that.
Are in part thought about in the same way we've been calculating savings for managed care for years. I think whatever you think of it, but based on a projection of what we would have paid in fee for service compared to managed care, based on those savings, we've convinced a lot of folks to give us a lot of money to be able to do lots of cool things based on those savings projections. So there is a way to think about and calculate savings within a taxpayer's budget.
On that note, any other comments? Let's move on. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay.
All right. So how about we do PCI and wake up Ed and see if we can knock this off before lunch.
This is limit coverage
for cutaneous coronary intervention.
You want me to talk about it?
Sure.
Okay. So, this is something we talked about the last time. And basically, the ACC, American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, and four other societies came out with appropriateness criteria in 2009. And these criteria are based on evidence-based medicine. They rely heavily on randomized controlled trials, particularly trial referred to as the COURAGE trial, which was in 2007, that demonstrated that a large percentage of patients with stable coronary artery disease, meaning coronary artery disease without a recent myocardial infarction, heart attack, or recent unstable angina, could benefit just as much with medical therapy as they could with PCI, coronary angioplasty. And so there have been national studies that have demonstrated that there are a large number of patients who fit those criteria who are still getting PCI, and in fact, we found the same thing is true in New York State. So our estimates are in here in terms of the percentage of patients who are currently getting PCI with stable coronary artery disease and the number of patients who are getting it, and then the cost per patient, reimbursement per patient for those patients. And so what has been done is to take the product of that that amount by the number of patients to come up with the estimate. That's a short description of questions on that.
Well, goodness, we got to see a lot about the evidence of this in previous meetings. I think it was our first meeting. So the one thing I would point out in here that's a little bit different from the proposals is embedded in this proposal is a specific recommendation that the savings from this initiative go to support the collection of the evidence and the information that makes proposals like this to actually happen. not cover, but also do quality and safety initiatives, of which this particular piece, I think, is only just one. The savings that we have in here, again, is fairly conservative. It's based on an initial proposal, taking non-standard claims for those ones in which there's clearly no evidence to benefit. And there are, as I presented previously, a whole other percentage of folks for which the evidence is equivocal, right, or unsupported.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are also cases in which there's insufficient documentation to really be able to make that decision. I think as we go forward, we certainly want to work on both of those areas.
That would be a better description, I think, yeah. Because certainly,
things have a way later downstream of getting expressive.
Every day.
Four words, and everybody's like, oh, they're not covering it at all.
Can you say more about the cardiac services registry?
Do you want to put it in this proposal, more about the cardiac services registry?
No, I just want to actually hear about it.
Oh, Ed, if you could just say a little bit about what the cardiac services registry is.
For the last 20 years or so, New York State has had registries for both cardiac surgery and for angioplasty. And these registries are used in order to produce annual reports that evaluate the quality of care for hospitals and for physicians. But also in the last decade or so, the registries have also been used to do a lot of comparative effectiveness research, comparing different kinds of stents, comparing bypass surgery with angioplasty, and a variety of other comparative effectiveness research studies.
Great, thank you. And one more question on the prior auth recommendation. How do you manage that on a fee-for-service basis? With the plans, they always have a prior auth in place, you know, process in place, but on fee-for-service, if someone wanted to request an elective PCI because they really felt there were complicating factors, how would you do that?
So that question was for us, Greg, about pre-auth. How would we, what's the mechanism that we have to do pre-auth and fee-for-service?
Well, we can put something up against some kind of automated process where you answer a series of questions against the appropriateness criteria and then get an authorization number if you say yeses to the telephonic prompts in the right places. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is to pay the claim in the first instance and have it as a retro review criteria in the second. Both have good and bad qualities to them.
But the latter is
a system
patient or for the provider, so I
think...
Pre-op,
real pre-op.
Yeah.
Come up with some examples of where we're doing pre-op and which one makes the most sense.
I mean, we could add it in. I mean, again, I think we just have to think about how to make the criteria for a telephonic response, and I'm betting that some insurers have done something similar that we could copy. But so your preference is that we not put it as a retro burden.
Right, and I thought the way it was described in here, it wasn't.
It is.
So,
I mean, the point is to stop.
Quality
issue. It's not about, oh, we're not going to pay you. It's really about it's the carrot and the stick. Good. Other questions or comments? Good. All those in favor?
Aye.
Try to do one more before lunch. hold you to a hard one before we do lunch, so we get it done.
We'll probably do an easy one like obesity.
The only thing between you and lunch is obesity.
Intensive behavioral counseling.
So Medicaid payment for intensive behavioral therapy for treatment of obesity. This is the one of the staples.
So reflecting two things. Two realities. One is the U.S. Preventive Task Force recommendations for intensive behavioral therapy, B ratings, both for adults and more recently for children. My general nod to sort of the level of evidence about doing this, but again, we're thinking about, people discuss sort of what intensive behavioral therapy really means relative to benefit. There is in addition, CMS starts to cover intensive behavioral therapy under Medicare and have some guidance that we, at least for now, sort of follow in terms of trying to do a fiscal on this in terms of projected cost. There are some differences in terms of how we would think about benefit for children and adolescents. We, in this particular write-up, we got both made use of the Preventive Task Force recommendation, the CMS guidance around the benefit they're providing for Medicare, as well as our obesity program within the state, Dr. Dennison, to create some of the projections in terms of how we'd actually deliver the service, what expected costs might be. And we deliberately, as you'll see, did two things. One is we're conservative about the number of folks who'd be eligible and make avail themselves of this for a variety of reasons, both sort of patient preference as well as the capacity of the system to be able to provide the service, which is still a bit of an unknown. And then second, we made zero projections about savings relative to this, which, again, if we wanted to wax poetic and hopeful, there's all sorts of, projections we could make about what the impact is of reducing obesity. I think that we were trying to be mindful of the fact that it's really still pretty early to be able to understand exactly what the impact of the specific service is going to be. We can project out what the impact is of obesity. Some of those numbers are also, as you know, in the literature have been debated. Clearly, it's a large cost. And with reductions in this area, I think everyone's on the same page about it. But going from there to understanding how the specific benefit is going to create cost savings as well is a leap that, at least at this point, we're a little uncomfortable putting hard numbers on savings in this document. That, Greg, is that fair?
It's fair, and especially for the short term. So as we think about sort of next year's budget, putting an in-year saving on ramping up products would have been probably speechless. And the longer-term savings are, we could probably add to this with a little time.
Next question about eligibility here. I understand how the adult side is in mind, but talking about the 96th percentile for the growth chart, I don't know if they've changed from 1980 and the fact that the prevalence of obesity among kids is a heck of a lot lower, and if the population overall shifted where we've got a heavier population, then that, I mean, which set of growth
charts
this is all kind of based on?
The growth charts are newer than the ones that you're referencing. But the whole issue in all of it is that it's a huge number of people, children.
Right.
We know that.
I was just taking this, Joe, out of material that, that we got, and I'm not sure if I'm reading it correctly, but this says that they have a BMI at the 95th percentile. So that might be a BMI percentile that they're talking about.
They are.
So I don't know that it's just the
growth. Well, with reference to what the entire population is, because if the whole population got heavier, you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. Yeah. BMI, I mean, the BMI calculations are there, and I think they're pretty good.
Okay.
I think we use them regularly. Schools use them regularly. Lots of settings use them regularly now. So I don't think that's the issue. I think those are good standard ways of looking at whether someone is overweight or not, and then when they reach obesity, et cetera, et cetera. So that I don't think is the issue. I don't know if this is the right time to bring it in. I just spent I spent the last 5 days in Boston at the National Conference and Exhibition of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And on Friday, there was a 4.5-hour symposium on childhood obesity and innovative practices going forward. And within that, the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, has this initiative. They just hired Judy Palfrey to be the CEO of that process. She is a professor of pediatrics at Harvard and immediate past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So they're really moving forward in that thing. I have to tell you candidly, I'm much more confused after going to that symposium than I was before I attended it in terms of what we really should be doing and going forward. One of the things that they spoke about was their sense of a comprehensive health benefit for kids would be four visits to a primary care physician, and in addition, 4 visits a year to a registered dietitian was their sense of comprehensive approach to the whole problem, to the whole process, which is different than what we're talking about in this particular paper. But the largest risk factor was clear in everybody's talk during that whole 4.5 hours is maternal and parental obesity. And we don't really see the impact on an anecdotal basis with any families when you have two very, very, very heavy parents coming in with heavy children. And we're not changing very much. And even in the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force B-level rating, I mean, there was weight loss, but it was like 2.2 kilo over the course of a year with no sense of whether that was maintained even in a long-term process. So I think we're at a point where we're all very, very concerned about this issue, and we really want to deal with it. And it does start in childhood and early in childhood, and we have to do something. But I'm not sure where it's all going or what we're doing or whether this is even the right approach when I look at it at the childhood level. So throwing that out there for us to realize.
It's really helpful. Just to clarify, this proposal really is all about obesity specifically and not overweight.
No, I understood that. Yes, yes. Well, and what we were talking about was childhood obesity there. But I'm telling you that it's not just the obese.
Right.
It's the overweight who are in that 75th to 95th percentile in terms of their BMI. So it's really it's a slope.
I think the societal concern is that by the time we're talking about therapeutic treatment of obesity with BMIs above 30 or whatever, we've already historically over careers of physicians trying to manage this, lost the game. It's really the prevention and the working with the overweight so they don't become obese.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm sorry. He's a little bit away from the microphone, so you may not be able to hear him.
Sorry, so that was it.
Okay.
When you're talking about intervening with the obese, you can get some benefit in very motivated people, but with society at large, it's very difficult to see that the investment that you're making is going to actually create any change.
So let's bring it back to this proposal.
Right.
Folks, other thoughts, comments?
I have a quick question. Isn't the percentile for kids up to a certain age and then
the BMIs change and they float and there is a chart if you look at it. But in terms of the percentile, 95th percentile, 85th percentile.
No, I understand, but when you're calculating it, don't you calculate percentile for kids up to the age of...
You start at age 2 and then it goes over until you reach the adult level.
So the percentile is up to age 2, And then it converts over
start,
to...
BMIs start being calculated at age 2. Uh-huh. Under age 2, you use a kind of a height-weight approach to the whole thing. After that, you use the BMI after age 2.
After
and then it's a different number each along the way. I mean, an 80-pound 3-year-old or 4-year-old, which I have one patient like, I mean, clearly has a BMI that's, I think, 24 or 26. It's not in the third range. It's huge for where she should be. Okay? She's usually, oh, well, she's obese. But it's not the same 30 or this or that. So it goes up the slope until you reach the late adolescent years. And then, of course, the adult level.
So at least by 18, you move off the percentile to just a pure number.
Well, no, I don't know how they count. I mean, I use it off height and weight, so when I'm looking at it, it's a calculated number. That calculator comes out of the height-weight ratio, and the standards for individual age groups as you move forward.
Scott, I'd like to speak strongly in favor of this proposal, given the obesity epidemic and the fact that this is a United States Preventive Services Task Force B recommendation. It is almost certainly worth the considerable expense that would be there, especially since we're looking for other ways simultaneously to save money. And I can attest to the fact that recommendations such as this have been found to offer high value when looked at in a longer time frame.
So that's a recurring theme, whether it's a concerned family partnership or other proposals that we're looking at, that the greater good into criminal justice and elsewhere outweighs the benefit to the Medicaid program. And I think that's important, that we should take that broader view. And that's part of why we're considering this. And as the CSCS recommendations may change over time, may become more specific over time, that may also change what this proposal looks like as it's affected in the state.
I have concern I'm in a rural area. I have no idea where I would refer someone for this therapy at all. I have no clue. I suspect maybe the same in inner city. Rural inner city is going to be very similar at times. As important as this issue is, there probably is no more important societal issue than this one. I'm dubious. Just from a career of 30 years, you know, people stop smoking, people start drinking, and I've had very little success over the years in obesity reduction. I'd like to believe in this.
I guess just a couple of picky points. As we're talking about the criteria for coverage, I think it's confusing if we're talking just about obesity to list the overweight criteria as well. If this is going to be a specific obesity proposal, we probably want to pull those pieces out for a different level of cost. The second thought is we talk about obesity care teams and we talk about intensive behavioral therapy. But we haven't really defined what that really means. And so it's hard to apply a number or a dollar amount to something that you don't really know what it means in terms of how you're going to implement it. So I'm not sure. It's great to have it in here, but I'm not sure we need to have a better definition of how we're going to implement it, because it's back to the confusion of, is it going to be primary care visits and dietary therapy? Is it going to be access issues? How are we going to define that particular piece? And do we really need to have in this financial impact discussion, a better discussion is it going to be, using the diabetes prevention programs, or is it going to be using, a more specific program, or how? It just doesn't seem to me like we have quite gotten that.
So we should distribute the description of the Medicare benefit, which gets closer to the detail that you're describing. Again, in making the leap from the task force recommendations to who should do it, at what frequency, what kind of training, it does not specifically answer your question to talk about the diabetes prevention program as to why it is clinically primary care based in terms of the description of the benefits. So it sort of, but it does not address, as far as I saw in the benefit description, what training, what specific curriculum. Get into enough of the details about what those interventions should be. So you're absolutely right. It's hard to do that. We made some, as with all new benefits, it's hard to do. It's a driven roadmap to follow experience. But made some best guesses about what this might cost, number of visits, again, based on looking at the Medicare status, what this regulatory suggests, what the number of visits that went through the time. But Medicare, they have some rules about if you don't make progress within 6 months, a certain degree, a certain percentage, they have for adults, and that's whatever it would be for kids. If you want to follow that, then there's no benefit that happens after that. I'm getting to your point about, is this really going to be effective? And we have some way of measuring or responding to what the impact is over time rather than being sort of open ended and unlimited benefit. The projections about the relatively modest projections about percent uptake take into consideration that your point about, are they really going to be folks to refer somebody who's willing to do this? I think it's an open question, a good one. And even with that relatively modest amount, you can see how staggering the costs are to be able to pay for this. So this is a big one. There's nothing that we just limited the cost to that I think comes close to paying. And if we're looking at balance being put out there yet, we're on the spending, tips us over on the spending side and likely becomes part of the waiver conversation or, unless we're able to come up with other ways in which it pays for itself. This is a huge investment.
Yeah, I think you may have answered some of my concerns also in addition to, to the details that Gene mentioned, specifically parameters around, how frequent and how long, I think obviously have to be in there. If you even assume 2 weeks, Q2 week, 20 sessions, you're going way longer than 6 months. And, unfortunately with a lot of these programs, to avoid them getting completely under control, there's got to be some stop order in there. Obviously, I agree with Scott about the general sense of it, but I can see that we can really become a monster if it's not, if there are not tight parameters around it.
Yeah, I think this is one of the examples where we'll have careful monitoring and quick changes as we ramp it up and see what's working and what's not working.
I would, is there a reason why we would not maybe consider including the diabetes prevention program as an evidence-based program in this recommendation as one of the ways of delivering?
It's a separate proposal. It's got a separate evidence base and different target population. We treat it separately from this particular initiative in part based on the way in which the recommendation is constructed based on the task force that doesn't specifically include a reference letter. And it is not, that specific program is not currently a AD recommended therapy in the same way that this is. So we prioritize this thinking about to put this up sort of the top of the list and put aside for that and other reasons the diabetes program is part of this. We're looking at currently how that program is currently operational with lots of pilots and demonstrations that are collecting information for New York with Medicaid member status impact. And through this incentive grant program that I talked about earlier, we want to test out those outcomes and participation levels. So we did not tag it with this proposal. It's not part of the 11
Any more discussion on this? Yes.
Is it possible to have some sort of pilot, smaller, he said 5%. I just don't know the task force population group, the same population group. I'm really concerned that this is going to divert dollars and attention and effort from other more compelling interventions.
So in the context of for benefits, that are applied in specific populations or specific geographies. There's sort of a formalized process of approval with CMS to do that. I would say the answer is yes. If you can, if you have a benefit, you're going to limit it to some and not give it to others. There's a formal process that they have to go through to be able to do that. Unfortunately, that takes away from some of the kind of experimentation that commercial insurers or employers may have in terms of targeting a benefit in one market, what impact it might have. So it's a possibility, something like that.
I wonder though also, this may be somebody keep going for these services if it's not having any effect, if they're not committed to weight loss? I mean, I don't know.
But when you go, having run some of these programs, what you find is that you'll find behavioral changes. You may not get weight reduction or BMI reduction, but you actually have people now drinking water instead of juice, having whole wheat bread versus regular bread. So you find a lot of behavioral changes. They may be walking a little bit more that are really worth the effort that you spend in them, but they may not be actually resulting in BMI reduction.
Did you say that there was a coverage by commercial carriers for obesity?
I think that's an important point. I don't know if that was Paloma or somebody else, but you know, the whole issue of dilution of behavioral therapies once they hit mainstream community-based care has been well documented. You know, so you do studies and they have these critical components, and then when you adopt them widespread, you find that those components are not being applied or not being applied well. I guess I share a lot of the concerns, although I am in spirit, you know, in favor of doing something important for obesity. I worry that the scope of this benefit is written so broadly that it's really not going to yield the benefit that we want. And the way to do that, I think, conceptually, although, again, it's a larger conversation, but I'd like to bring it up in this group, is that we need to have some measures that are robust when we think about expanding behavioral or psychological therapies. And those measures need to be, just like in the PCI realm and others, measurable things that people report on so that you can audit them later to see what results occurred. And it's not as simple as, in this instance, BMI, but it's also the behavioral changes, as Paloma's pointing out. And we really need to be mindful of those things, because later on you spent all this money, you're not really sure what you got in return.
I think what I'm hearing from around the room is that there are a lot of concerns with the potential scope of this proposal. That being said, it's a USPSTF, you know, grade A or B recommendation, and as a general principle, we want to go down that road of going along with the USPSTF. There are ways we could probably roll this out that are thoughtful and more deliberate that would allow us to get some of the metrics on success. For example, I know we have in New York State, in law at least, we're supposed to be getting BMIs from schools on all kids. There's been variable compliance with that, and we are making a push to get much better compliance across the board with SED to the extent that we can make changes. So there may be the possibility where we tie this in with other efforts that are ongoing to say this is important to us for the following reasons. These are the spend amounts that we're doing. This is why we need the outcome data, and thereby move the whole field forward on this very important issue. There will be issues in the North Country and elsewhere in terms of how do we get this done. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It means that we need to think about scope of practice. We need to think about other issues as well. So the general sense I'm getting is this is a good thing. We need to figure out how to do it, and that's going to be very important. So I would suggest that we move on at this point with whatever you guys want to vote on this. But realize that when we do affect it, we'll have to be very deliberate.
Question was, do commercial carriers provide coverage for this type of service? And if so, is there any outcomes data on that?
I guess the short answer is that there is not a New York State mandated benefit for treatment of obesity. There are if there's a recognition of the law of certified dietitians, many employer groups contract with wellness companies to include an obesity benefit for the workforce, but it's not a mandated benefit either for individuals or
organizations. Typically, just tailored through how the delivery system operates. So if you're an intern and you have somebody who's interested in reducing their weight, you can help them get to the services that will
But for Medicare, I think the big payer that says that covered benefits, talking about for commercial, more variable.
But for clarity, we're only looking at providing the individuals who are self-pick of BMI greater than 30, because you got overweight throughout the year, too.
That's right.
That's coming out.
That's
coming out. So only going with the people that are truly obese, quite frankly.
children have DMI.
Okay. So in an effort to maybe throw out something to address the concerns, I think there's two things that we've heard. One is we should figure out a way to do something like this that's B-rated, but we should figure out a way to choke it so that it doesn't sort of get out of our control. One thought I had was we're rolling out statewide over time the implementation of health homes. These are for people with multiple chronic conditions. High BMI is a qualifying criteria for one of those conditions. So one way to potentially limit this is to authorize the benefit for individuals that are enrolled in health homes and potentially delivered by the health home network, which would be pre-approved by the state. So it would limit, A, the people going in. It would limit, B, the network of providers from whom someone could get the service. And it would attach on Henry's side, we'd get a chance to think about some performance metrics that the health home could report on specific to the servicing population.
And then based on that, roll it out broader.
As a practitioner at the Women's Health Center at the Bronx VA, I can just tell you this program is the go-to program for our vets coming back. And that's probably a way of looking, not reinventing the wheel, but looking at that as a way of adopting some of the missteps and actual good steps that have gone through the program. Now, so we can look at their experiences.
So any concerns in tying this to the health home, at least initially, and then going from there?
That's being rolled out between now and June, right? So if this becomes a recommendation, that's part of the decision, part of the budget? Yeah. So it's not approved till April. How much are we, I mean, by the end of June,
this would be
the health home is fully rolled out, right?
Right. So what we would say is that in order to get access, and again, we've got to go across the CMS and do some due diligence on this idea, but that we would offer the service through those providers that were enrolled with us as health homes. So say that we implement the program next fall. We implement it through those networks that were approved as part of health homes.
Would you bake that into the FMAP reimbursement from the feds for the health home? Because that has an impact for the state budget, too.
Potentially, the portion of this that is care coordination would be covered, but we couldn't pay for education.
Okay.
I would only be concerned that the people that are targeted with the health homes are the really high-risk, chronically ill, even though they're the ones who could benefit from this. But at the same time, they're the ones that are maybe not connected to care, so you're encountering a difficult population to start with.
Well, health home is two chronic conditions, right, is our initial go, or you've got schizophrenia, or you have HIV. We can grow towards one chronic condition at risk of another under the federal criteria. BMI is, having high BMI is considered a chronic condition. So frankly, if you have a high BMI and you're diabetic, you can be in. So I think it would be a choke on the patients, and part of this is actually why I offered it as a suggestion, because I was hearing some concern about scope.
Well, there is an ACA around A and B rating recommendations. There's some inducement. I'm trying to remember the details of the inducement. It's not 100%.
If, however, you limit it to health homes, how do you deal with the children in there? Because that's that would have to be very different.
Also, we're working on a longer-term plan to put together kids' health homes so we could, again, attach that to those health homes.
Do you still have a statewide this issue, though?
We may. But I think the point at which we would implement it is when we had access to health homes statewide. But again, we still have to talk to CMS.
Health homes is one idea about how to narrow it or whatever.
We could put a menu of ideas. I think the group's thinking about ways to choke it. It was just one that occurred off the top.
Well, I was thinking about children. How would you play into the significantly overweight, if not quite obese kids yet, who are really at this low point, where you want to have an intervention if you went and only did it that way?
So let's think about it some more. We'll get back to you with several options in terms of...
But I'm
I agree with Scott. I strongly support it. I'm just really confused after that 4.5 hours.
All these grand experts.
The more you know, the less you know.
Well, yeah.
The home thing won't work for kids.
Right.
It won't. Because
right.
They very often won't have that second qualifying diagnosis.
Right.
So, Greg, along those same lines, maybe we want to think something around kids, because kids really are the best place to get the most impact.
So let's think about it. Maybe it's not our current definition of a health home, but getting towards something that allows the infrastructure to provide the care that's needed. With the backstop of the data. Health home is one way we have that data.
Yeah, patient-centered medical homes is another one.
Yeah. So let's get back to this. We'll look on this and get back to this. All those in favor of something like this in general?
We have 5 proposals yet after lunch, so why don't we, if we can do like 15, 20 minutes of lunch.
12:50 right now, let's do 1:10.
Coming
down, and
lunch is
here for
that.
We're going to break for lunch, and we will come back at 1:10.
And we have 5 more proposals to discuss. We've kept a few hard ones for now. So the postprandial phase is a good time to think hard. Let's start with the cesarean section one.
Okay.
And the elective.
Okay.
Folks on the phone, we're starting again. You are off of mute. We can hear you if you can.
In retrospect, probably these 2 proposals could have, should have been put together. Perhaps we will for the next version. But I would suggest you think about the eliminating Medicaid coverage for elective induction of labor less than 39 weeks of that medical indication, and the same for draft as eliminating Medicaid coverage of elective C-sections of labor less than 39 weeks with that medical indication. We basically build on the same evidence base. Our aim in the same direction. Our savings are also connected to each other. And
they're actually identical. The savings have been combined, and each savings is reflected individually in the sheet, but not broken apart for the proposal. So the savings are pre-collapsed. I think the proposal itself could likely be collapsed.
So, I'll very high level view of this. There is a significant amount of evidence about the benefits of full-term delivery and the even differences of 1 week. And a number of projects, a number of organizations, including ACOG, including the March of Dimes, including many states and so on, have been specifically working in the area of both education and training and improvement programs related to, number one, improving documentation relative to medical indications for any induction less than 39 weeks. Trying to change the culture, trying to change decision-making, trying to bring the evidence to bear around the impact of even 1 week early delivery. Connected to that have been a number of initiatives, March 9th, and others have led around accurate dating and ultrasound dating and so on, in a way in which obviously that plays into the importance of being able to really execute them. There are a number of what I would say, improvement projects going on nationally and in New York. I think the hospital associations and ACOG is involved in a number of them. There are institutions that have instituted the quote-unquote hard stop. That is, before, in some places, depending on the chief of OBGYN, there may be a process whereby if you're going to do an induction less than 39 weeks or C-section, there actually has to be some process, if you will, like a pre-law process, a conversation that needs to happen. There's a project that the department has been working on in conjunction with the National Initiative for Child Health Quality, based out of initially an initiative that CMS started and that has had a few years of life in states like Ohio and California, aimed in a specific direction. And there's a laundry list of reasons why avoiding this for medical education makes sense and the impact it has
positive impact it has, both on infants and on self-delivering mothers. There's clearly also potential cost savings associated with full-term delivery as well. We tried to outline what we project based on the data that we have, making use of states like Ohio that have had some experience in this, and also looking at some of the literature around them. Looking at our own data and looking at financial impact and looking at those deliveries between 36 and 81, 38 weeks, we have about 20% of deliveries are in that area. About 51, over half of them were delivered spontaneously. About 31% were delivered that have an indication. We're leaving aside for now in this conversation, but the legitimate secondary down the road conversation, what are reasonable medical indications for doing this as sort of a phase two, if you will. But for now, based on the data that we have, and this is looking at some data on a project that I mentioned with the health department, about 15% were induced for C-section with that indication. This is using New York State data, this is relatively recent. Now, how much of that is documentation? How much of that is not real indication? I think in most of the projects that have worked in this area, the first thing that happens is through documentation. If you're cynical, you say, well, it's just kind of gaming and, you know, things in there. But I think that there's legitimate and real documentation issues, including on vital statistics and so on, which are often the source of these analyses. But even with the increased documentation, there clearly are instances in which there is no clear medical indication for the induction. There are in Ohio and probably in facilities in New York and elsewhere places that have virtually brought this almost to zero. That zero, you know, deliveries without medical indication, without documented medical indication. So we know it can be done, and you know, beginning to collect information about what that impact might be. The second part of the page, you know, again, create some relatively conservative estimates about reductions, and it's really just focused on NICU stay as being one of the most costly, and I would say one of the most troublesome unintended effects of early delivery, and make some estimates in terms of our cost savings for this based on a 2% reduction against the number of NICU stays that we had, and this is looking at 2007 data. I don't think it's substantially changed over the past few years. Those savings are about $5 million a year, and I would just say, in the projects like the ones in Ohio, they're estimating based on their ROI something in the order of $50 million a year in savings, and that's just, again, specifically just looking at NICU costs, not looking at other expenses related to a mom and other sort of secondary impacts of early delivery, of which there are a number. We did circulate a letter from ACOG, which raised a number of questions and concerns about the implementation or the adoption of this. I hope you had a chance. I know that many of you had a chance to take a look at that. And, you know, certainly to discuss what some of those issues have been done. I have a letter in front of me, but some of you may, and George maybe will remember all the particulars, but there were concerns about exceptions and exceptional cases. I think there was concern about sort of being a punitive thing to clinicians. There was concern about education and making sure that folks understand in advance that this is coming. Anybody else remember what some of that, George, something out here, whether some of the other...
Blizzard.
We have these exceptions and exceptional cases.
And how do you monitor? I think you all agree that it's a good idea in terms of its ability to decrease those babies in the NICU who don't have a clear indication for delivery. But then how do you implement it? And I think that's where the devil's in the details. We have to actually figure out where we're actually doing what we intend to do without having an adverse impact on the patient or baby in terms of those exceptions that may come up. So how do you measure, if someone with cold stages of pregnancy is being delivered at 36 weeks, for instance, and, you know, are we going to somehow code it so that medical condition is going to be there? And what about when you have a code that doesn't exist, like for birth and incision, and you just know that, you know, because that mother is at risk of, for a deep section, rupture of the uterus, and there's no code for that. How do you actually take that into account? There are probably some instances where we know and we can mention them, but some other instances that we don't know, and that we're going to have to make that decision at that time. Do you really want to set it up so that it's a hard stop in all cases, or do you want to implement it over time, gather some more information? I mean, we all agree that, you know, what we're trying to do is the right thing, but the devil's really in the details.
But do you agree that doctors will always do the right thing for their patients?
I think in most cases, yes.
And that a financial concern alone would push them to doing the wrong thing for their patients? No, I'm asking seriously. Like, you know, what's going to happen? At the end of the day, this is right for mom. There's a blizzard coming. We got to get it done. Let's worry about the money later.
Right.
And in 99.9% of the time, that's going to be the kind of decision that's made.
Yeah, I mean, there are social issues that come up that you can't put a finger on. That is a decision between the doctor and the patient, and that's something that we don't want to get into any kind of an adversarial role, I think. So I think that, you know, as long as we roll it out and have a way of taking that sort of thing into account, and then, because we don't want to give the patient or the provider the impression that we're running roughshod over their decision. I just don't want to get into that also. So I think that, you know, a thoughtful kind of implementation process where, you know, we know that we're doing what the evidence shows is best, and at the same time, making sure that we're not putting a wedge between the state and the provider and the mother, I think, is an important thing. So it's a matter of, you know, how we want to project ourselves to our clients.
Can you talk about administration? Because, you know, this is what we got hung up with this last year. We really couldn't figure out how we could administer this program.
Administration.
Sorry.
So I think most of this, if I view this, most of this is retrospective. And one of the things that I think isn't clear enough in this description, but probably should talk about, is that I don't think, as I view the proposal, the sound is if it's no payment, right? I think what we're talking about is no incremental payment beyond a delivery, right? That's part of this, and how that works out in terms of cost and cost savings, I think, is something we have to take back. So I think it is sort of, it is retrospective, and not, you know, I don't think, again, we want to be in a position of doing pre-op, although that's a conversation that we can have about this. And, the other thing that was raised in the letter, think about it, is this issue of what the evidence base for non-payment is actually contributing to the reduction.
How does it change behavior?
Most of the initiatives and interventions that are in literature are really coupled, are really multifactorial, multimodal interventions, like the one in Ohio that wasn't a hard stop at non-payment, but was more about putting systems in place so that we have. And so there are a number of states and a number of payers that kind of are experimenting with a non-payment policy for this, but I don't think we know yet what the specific impact is of non-payment on this. But we think that non-payment, we're making that statement prospectively, has some impact on behavior. Again, some of that impact will be around increasing coding, but we're also hoping that it makes a consistent statement with professional societies and with projects that are currently going on that reinforce the message about not doing this work when there's no medical indication.
Yeah.
Well, my view then is I think this is like these two recommendations are worth pursuing. It's how you implement this. And if you think that this is true, we have to hold off on this because driving a wedge between the patient and the doc. Well, we make the same arguments for what we just talked about for the cardiac procedures, for the back procedures, for the knee procedures and all that. We need to say, yes, we're going to fight to pursue this, and then how we do roll it out. So what would be the process for exception? So if you do have a situation where there's nothing codable, but there is a really good reason for it, then you can have that appealed and then review, but But I think in general, to say, no, we're not going to do this, I think that's really being inconsistent after all the discussions we had about the other stuff that we...
I would agree. I mean, you should implement it in some way. There's the question of how, and again, do you do a broad brush kind of thing where everyone's impacted, you cut off everyone, or do you just look at those? In Minnesota, they've tried where, you know, those hospitals that actually have a program like we have in Helping Hospitals at Elmhurst, where there's very little, or there's a hard stop, so no one in that particular hospital is going to be able to do an induction of labor 39, you know, unless it's 39 weeks or above. That, in that, like in Minnesota, what they do is hospitals that have that kind of quality initiative are accepted. And then those hospitals that can't give some sort of a quality initiative program that the commissioner actually approves of, they want to do a target. So if we wanted to, you know, I don't know whether that's allowable, but I'm just saying there's other ways of approaching the problem so that you actually get to who you're actually trying to influence the most, rather than just, you know, broad brushing everybody and saying everyone, even if you're doing a good job, you're going to be penalized in some way, shape, or form.
One of the things that I think is there's clearly variation in terms of performance by physician of it. Hard stops, I think, you know, have different performance. But one of the things that I recall from looking at, I think it was blinded data across a number of institutions in the project that was referenced, is, you know, sort of it's there everywhere. And again, so some of that may be documentation issues, but I think what's striking is even at, you know, regional perineal centers, there wasn't an institution that would somehow be in a significant percentage of the staff. So I don't know if Arne, what you're proposing. I mean, the other way to go is, gee, should there be statute that says that all hospitals without maternity have a hard stop program, and that legislation would have to. Another way of potentially getting at something like this that would reach all payers, I don't think you want to go there. My guess is there'd be significant concerns and objections around. I think the other point that you may or may not be making, but I would make, is that this isn't an initiative in isolation, but there are a number of other initiatives going on that are not, you know, non-payment, but are more in the realm of data and data feedback and quality improvement. Some of them have been going on for a while, right? Some of these recommendations are not, you know, brand new. The challenge in this profession, as in all professions, is sort of the length of time it takes for to change minds and hard through behavior. And I think what we're trying to do is sort of accelerate that time frame.
In terms of the implementation, beyond it being retrospective, I mean, where we got this last year, so, okay, how do you administer that? Are you going to deny, okay, all C-sections automatically at the non-C-section rate and then have it appealed, and that was volume that you guys couldn't handle? And then we tried to look at, you know, are there specific codes that we could identify, and that became difficult. So that's sort of my question, because what we ended up with then, because we couldn't figure out the implementation, there were dollars in the budget, and that just became an across-the-board cut. So you're not achieving what you're setting out to do by linking payment to quality.
Yeah, I think, though, the thing that we all understand is that this is a patient safety issue, and that there is a large degree of unacceptable, unexplainable variation in the current practice. And the challenge is, how do we, first of all, reduce that variation, you know, for across, both within and across providers, and then also do it in a fashion that's quick enough that moves things in the right direction. There are different tools that we've tried. This is one tool that we may want to try, or we may not want to try. I'm at a loss in terms of what we should do or how we should do it. I'd actually like to take my prerogative to ask Donna if she wants to add some comments.
You know, I think from ACOG's perspective, it's an excellent proposal.
Can you come up closer so the folks on the phone can
hear? It's an excellent proposal and one that should go forward, because you do then make that statement that this is unacceptable behavior and ACOG will support you. I think, to your point, it's an And so I think what Minnesota did effectively was postpone the implementation date, so that when you want to go savings next year, you may not be able to until perhaps 2013 so that you can work out those implementation dilemmas. But by putting forward the same proposal, you're going to be right back where you were last year, I think.
So I envision something like this in terms of implementation as I think about it. So it's retrospective, it's looking at the data and looking at coding indications, whether it's on VS data, which has lags and there's an issue there, or on claims data, to see whether in fact there are indications. The issue that you raised, George, about coding is a real concern. So, you know, in my mind, the areas, the cases that we can identify that have indications are nothing happened. So it's the subset of the review are those cases in which it's been done, you know, less than 39 weeks, and there's no indication that we can see, you know, whether we're using VS data, whether we're using claims data, whether we're inventing something that we're being able to evaluate it based on other kind of data collection that we might have. So that limits the focus of the review, and then the review would be, is this a documentation issue? Is this what was it? That, to me, that starts to narrow the scope, but I think we have the capacity to do that kind of review.
So you're talking more like a retrospective audit type process.
Correct. That's how
it happens. And I want to just bring something else with me. You know, we have this global Medicaid cap, $640 million, right? It's changed behavior. I truly believe that hospitals are readmitting lower, that they're changing their practices, that they're, that a big savings has come because of the fear of that cap. No other, you know, tangible thing other than there's going to be a cap. If we don't make it, we're going to get cut across the board. We know we need to change behavior. We're going to take all these borderline cases and make specific changes. That's a real part of us staying under the cap today. To the extent that the fear of electives not being paid for will mean that all those golf games that you suggested will go away, it'll change behavior alone, whether or not we actually do anything. The fear of the change that electives are not acceptable will change those marginal cases in the right direction. And then a year from now, we may not want to do anything. I'm not saying that. I don't want to say that out loud because we do want people to be afraid. But that alone will change the marginal cases. It's the marginal cases that we're really concerned about. It's not the couple.
Is there a way then, agreeing with what you've said, to incorporate clinically accepted medical guidance of some sort? Because there clearly is defined exceptions, both through the March of Dimes, through ACOG, through AAP, where we indicate if you need to do a medical induction or you need to do something. And so there are. So if there was a way to perhaps advance these proposals and insert some language that just said according to some, and you don't even have to mention ACOG, just accepted medical criteria or medical indications, that might be.
There wasn't any desire to get ahead of or make up something.
Right.
So as I view these proposals, implementation based on what are the accepted criteria for medical indications. Now, as you know and I know, there's lively debate about the strength of evidence for those medical indications. And that's going to go on, and we're not going to fix that, I think, with this proposal. I think, like in any of these proposals, I think what we're going to do is to take the things around which there's agreement. No justification, no medical indication documented from 20 feet. And that's the place where we want to start. Understanding that there's no desire here to not pay for services that have good evidence base or medical care. I think that's not where we want to go. But I think we have to recognize that there are these indication areas around which the profession itself has some debate and some discussion about, you know, how soft, how hard, how good is the evidence around that. And that's, you know, that's fair, and that's probably going to continue for a while. I don't think we want to jump ahead of that evidence. But as the evidence base hopefully gets better about indications, then, you know, we might. But, you know, we have no desire to be, I think, ahead of that.
Is there any precedence for physician self-reporting? I don't want to add more paperwork to what we do, but we do a lot. However, is there any precedence from a regulatory point of view that you're aware of where physician self-reporting might actually help decrease the burden on the department in terms of figuring out?
Like a self-attestation related to specific cases.
Something like what you do with, you know,
cost a whole lot of money to implement something like that?
You know, it's hard to do it well, but I think there is precedent for doing it. I think we're open to ideas about how to make the implementation of this make sense. I mean, once again, as I think of our conversation, it's not an opposition to the idea. It's a lot around the implementation
process.
Right. It's concerned about it being arbitrary or unfair or unreasonable or not being in accord with where the evidence is.
If we landed in a place where we thought a retro review implementation was acceptable for the group, and we all agreed that we had to come up with what the sort of rule-in, rule-out criteria were, at least for the stuff that was more black and white, and then we could use some gray stuff for another process, which I'm assuming is a relatively low volume, should be evenly distributed by hospital, by private provider, and then looked at it from the lens of quality, just in terms of, you know, who is continuing to drive, you know, more of these outlier cases. Just from the perspective of, you know, a quality improvement follow-up on top of the sort of high-pro-level review of the support for the DRG, I think that just sends a signal that this is not just a payment reduction, but it's also a quality initiative. And if we could agree that there would be an entity or a body that would come together to come up with what is, I'll just call it the chart review criteria, IPRO criteria for looking at the DRG reviews, then maybe we table the discussion about the what for the later day, but it seems like somehow, even on the bright line stuff, we could drag 4,500 cases way down and then focus on where the outliers are on the quality.
Let me point out, there's, unlike previous puzzles, the savings here is not about cuts.
Yeah.
And should have said that up front. The savings here is all around making. So there's nothing in the savings proposal that, you know, because, again, the notion here is the deliveries are going to happen. The payments are going to be delivered. What we're trying to do is, you know,
Kathy's going to say back to you, the proposal is to eliminate coverage. So
right.
Even though we didn't count the savings, that
correct.
There would have to be, there was envisioned a stick. And the stick, I think we're saying, would be a retrospective stick.
Correct.
And it would be structured around some kind of group that would come together and
I would say there's caution in implementing anything that requires additional retrospective review because while, you know, in theory it's handled by IPRO with an outside entity, in reality the institutions have an immense burden of pulling together the information. And you're really transferring, you know, that burden onto, you know, onto the institution. My preference is the literature is, you know, clear and most of you seem to think it is. You know, is to do what you're proposing, and then obviously if there are individual cases, you know, they can be handled however the way they handle. But the idea of some, you know, major IPRO review being added on to everything that has to be reviewed now, I would not be in favor of.
Didn't you know ICD-10 has greater granularity or specificity relative to...
Yes, it has. Yes, no matter what the question.
On the managed care side, I'm assuming that in the next 3 years, most of these pregnancies are going to end up in managed care, correct?
Right.
I mean, that's the whole plan here. We require for some procedures that there's got to be a documentation for why it was done, I mean, for some of the stuff that some especially folks do. So if this number is going to go down because everyone's embracing ACOG's recommendations, from the managed care side, someone's going to do this in order to get paid for it. If it's like before the 39 weeks, the either C-section or a medical induction, they're going to have to show me why there was a real good reason for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same as if you do extend the other good thing.
We don't need to do this.
Well. But I think the thing is, I mean, for the here and now, the reality is for the fee-for-service side, it's going to not be as big an issue for...
The implementation will be the plan.
It will be eventually, yeah. But I mean, we do it already. So the thing is, you know, if someone really is, you know, believe they've got to do this and they've got really a reason for it, if I'm going to require them to show me why, you know, that's going to be the speed bump for everybody that they want to do it because they've got a...
tea time or something like that that they have to go and find out.
How do you do it? Do you do a denial and then an appeal?
No, when they submit the claim, it comes along with the claim, basically.
Wow, but
that's a prospective. It's prospective. I'm not going to do, you know, otherwise I'm going to put a hard stop. If they don't have it with the documentation, they don't get paid.
Yeah, in New York State, you don't get paid for hysterectomy or sterilization unless you have the paper filled out.
Right.
We do that now for those?
Yeah.
So it's but it's additional documentation beyond the normal claim.
Right. So, I mean, the thing is, it goes with the claim.
Yeah. And that's kind of, that's what you were getting at, the documentation and the process.
Yeah.
I do think the quality argument here is so compelling, and the evidence is so clear compared to almost anything else we've talked about, that to lead with a quality safety argument for mother and baby is where you go, and the cost will come or whatever, but that's really not relevant to the strong argument.
Donna, last thought?
I would ask strongly if some kind of language then could be added to your point, Greg, about how to implement it, I think. I think by being silent, you beg the question again of having it come back. This would be the second time.
And, you know, honestly, if you keep the savings around the NICU cost, I think that's one thing. But, you know, we don't want to be in the same situation as we were last year where administration became a problem and so money was just taken out.
It was different proposals.
So I
think what I would recommend to do is that we add language here that there be further exploration of implementation in the plans and in fee-for-service, and specifically around criteria for either prospective or retrospective approval, and that we would reference some groups that would help us with that. Is that reasonable?
Not as hard as I thought.
Before we leave it. So on the dollar savings, are these the numbers that you're sticking with, or did you say you were going to be adding more to that?
I wasn't going to book any more savings on this. It's just a question of other savings may materialize if
that's fine.
You just don't want it to morph into something else. Yeah, I get it. Okay. No morphing.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
All those against? No. Okay.
That'd be awesome to change that number. You know, you look at the Ohio stuff, it was just incredible.
Okay. Dentist. Which one did we get to?
We did both.
Okay. He's actually in the body. Thank you. So we have three left. One of the goes to expanded coverage of
smoking cessation with dentists.
So one of the color ones. It leaked through the color printer. My apologies. You're printing this morning.
Extra copies sent to me.
Thank you.
We at one of the early meetings talked about our current Medicaid smoking tobacco cessation benefit, which by any measure is pretty generous, but yet we know that is very underused. And so part of this comes out of our mutual desire, our collective desire to increase access to what is a very good benefit for something that has great evidence base, that has return on investment, and saves lives, that is overrepresent low-income individuals, so it has relevance to our program. We had initially the request was for coverage of dentists and pharmacists. We tell you that we took pharmacists off the list, partly due to the evidence base, which we thought was not as strong as it was for dentists, as well as the reality that lots of pharmacists operate through venues in which we sell tobacco products, and that creates some challenges, I think, at the current time, thinking and rationalizing coverage. So you'll see that this description really takes you through the evidence base specifically around access to benefit and delivery by dentists. I'm not going to belabor all the evidence about tobacco cessation. I think we are cognizant of it. The numbers I think to just keep in mind are the tremendous prevalence still of tobacco use in our program, around 30%. Or so, actually higher.
subpopulations that have chronic disease, certainly higher in the population with behavioral health and substance disorders as well. And those markets or agencies that have initiated a number of programs trying to make a dent in that. There is also, in terms of the current use of benefit, from our best estimate, both the number of smokers and calculating use of the benefit putting together, both prescription over-the-counter and counseling services, about 17% of smokers use the benefit, something in that regard. And we have sort of an internal and external explicit goal of trying to move that to 40%, which we know is achievable based on what some other states have been able to do. And part of some of the calculations in here in financial impact is really kind of talks to what happens if that is that we go from 17% an increase in terms of percent that use the benefit and the number that stop smoking. Tobacco cessation is, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that we're looking to try to provide specific incentives around with the incentive grants as well. This is an existing benefit. Really, what we're really talking about here is expanding the types of providers who are eligible to provide the benefit. So, happy to answer any questions. I don't know. Ira,
I think this is an excellent summary, an excellent brief. I mean, clearly, just to reiterate a few of your comments, this is an important action because these are the patients that need this service. We also see the dental office as a place that's underutilized as a point of contact with the healthcare system. And this is opening the door, I think, in a very important way. I think it will also open coverage, and we've already held those discussions with the commercial carriers. State of New York is doing this, the Medicaid program, you should be doing it as well. And they actually have there's been interest both in Aetna, MetLife, and others about sort of understanding more about this. One of the things Joe and I were discussing a little bit about who's going to actually deliver this message in the dental office, will it be the dentist, or will it be the hygienist? Compensation here is limited, important, no one's complaining about that. But I think it has to be open to allow the hygienist to do this as long as that person is well-trained, appropriately trained. And the provisions, as again noted in the brief, indicate continuing education, smoking cessation is part of that education. That has to be allowed as well. That's currently what happens in dental offices. If you see a dental hygienist for dental cleaning, the dentist actually will be billed for that service, but it will be provided by the hygienist. So, obviously, I am in favor of it, and I know that the academic dental centers in New York are very much in favor of it. And I think the state of New York,
This is Henry. I think this is an excellent proposal. I think there's tremendous merit and it's very well written. The question I have relates to dental preparation to prescribe medications other than nicotine replacement, like bupropion and also Chantix, and whether or not the dental expert in the room feels that as part of training, particularly around follow-up, that issues of emergent suicidality are going to be addressed if they go down the road of using non-nicotine replacement therapies. Your thoughts on that?
I think it's a very, very good question, and that's addressed in the continuing education programs, both dentists who want relicensure as well as in school. Those issues are really addressed. And the prescription drug usage is still being defined. Clearly, the suggestion is made that this is done in cooperation with medical, though it's still in a hazy stage. But it has certainly brought across in the continuing education programs that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, I think in terms of your model, again, I think this is outstanding. It's generally speaking, if you provide, either bupropion or Chantix for the treatment. Some protocol around bringing the person back for an assessment and just questioning about any other emergent psychiatric symptoms would be important. But again, I'm generally speaking very much in support of this.
Yeah, now, there is some limitations in that. If you consider the benefit as described here, I think it's two visits a year, and the recommended visit sequence is short. But I think it's properly emphasized in the education
module. I'd like to reinforce of the content that I've been invited to do is tough enough to have a dental network if you really want to have an individual in practice that is up at the highest level of the licensure. So I really appreciate a dentist saying what you ought to quit smoking and all that, but to expect them to be doing the whole educational component to it because it's tough enough to get the authoritative services done to be able to do that but under the how the dentist should make a lot of sense, and I wouldn't want it to be purely under the someone like you've got a DBS or a DMD to be able to do it.
I would just question, I mean, we limit it to physicians, physician's assistants, and registered nurse practitioners, which is a higher level of license than an RN or an LPN on the physician side of the equation as to where this education is allowed to occur. And I'm not sure what the hygienist level of education is that is different than an RN's education, that we have such a disparity there.
Well, it varies. There are master's level hygienists who have both a baccalaureate and a master's degree, and others have associate degrees plus the clinical training in addition to that. It's really variable.
It's a scope of practice, because I don't know anything about the dental side.
It's the same for all hygienists.
So a BSN or a master's level trained nurse is maybe not, I guess I'm confused in that, how that would play out as to what we have physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs doing different than what we have dentists doing.
Well, let me answer the question perhaps on a different slant. At least in the United States in general, there's some data from New York, but the U.S. data is better. The average, about 70% of Americans, adults, see a dentist at least once a year. That's higher than the percentage that see a physician. So consequently, I think there's an access issue that would be addressed. Your question really speaks to whether the hygienist would be capable of providing...
Yeah, should the hygienist be doing it? Should the dentist be doing it?
I think ideally it should be the dentist, but for reasons that we're discussing, it just may not be feasible in the kind of practices that it's going to be implemented. It may not be very ineffective. But I think it should be open, not exclusively one or the certainly not. Not just dentists.
Your comment is on the medical side.
On the medical side.
We've created a bar to say that RNs can't do it.
That's correct.
And, you know, what is the rationale and the logic behind saying nurses can't do it, which may be bachelor's or master's for that matter, but hygienists can't.
Right. That is right.
And do you know, is the data on the efficacy specifically related to the nursing data that physician specifically?
Efficacy data is from dentists.
So I think as we think about the design, I mean, again, this is a trade-off we have all the time, which is, you know, which practitioners does the evidence suggest? What's the issues in terms of creating benefits? An access issue and so on, and then you have, can we make a logical, is it logical that the hygienist can, but the nurses can't?
I think we'll have to come back with evidence suggesting, that hygienists can be as effective as
dentists.
So as it reads, it's currently dentists.
As it reads, it's dentists. Desire it.
Yeah. So I think the practicality of it is that to get authoritative services is probably a more pressing need insofar as who can do it, but this population, because there is, it's not every dentist in New York State willingly embracing the Medicaid population of private. So then, you know, who ends up doing it? So from my perspective, I think that it's really a lot better than not having this happen in the dental environment at all. Because, I mean, if you're getting your pull, say you're getting your tooth pulled or something like that, I mean, that's a moment that's teachable in terms of, well, maybe one of the reasons why we're doing this is because you got significant periodontal disease, you smoke two packs of cigarettes a day, and you can maybe leverage that. But still, I don't think the access and the capacity is the issue.
So my best guess is this is going to be one where we don't utilize it as much as we'd like to.
Right.
If we limit it to dentists, you know, dentists who provide Medicaid are a very small percent.
Right.
And not extended. But on the other hand, it's a step in the right direction. And maybe what we can do as we roll it out, start here, get feedback, get more evidence on other providers using it, maybe level the playing field beyond just the dental side and the nursing side.
I think many of these changes are just going to evolve. And I think this will be the same. The evidence really has been developed with dentists as a provider of the institution. That's what we're saying with them.
I think that's the consensus I'm hearing. Also may reduce the number of practice meetings my folks have.
No, it
would reduce that.
This will not be an education department issue in terms of scope of practice for dentists. Of course, they're very...
The hygienist.
So that would be a good issue.
Yeah.
Other thoughts or comments? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Again?
Okay, good go. Let's see short factor. This one is relatively straightforward. This actually came from, I think, a suggestion from MRT 1. That was not taken up, and this proposal is around limiting use of growth hormones in those clinical scenarios in which there is specifically growth hormone deficiency versus also opening the door to treatment for idiopathic short stature, which is a real condition around which growth hormone potentially has some impact. But I think the argument being made here is that, the improvement is small relative to the cost, and we're retaining the benefit for those that have genuine growth hormone deficiency. And the theory is that significant savings related to...
$40 million.
I'm not a joke.
So that's the... That's the longest haul.
So good.
I'm sorry. I couldn't help myself.
The short version.
The short version. Thank you. You can David, Bob, anything?
My comment is the last meeting you sent comes in today. You know, I think that this is an important thing to do. I think it's the right thing to do. And certainly from an evidence standpoint, the drug side is
okay.
Ditto.
Great. All those in favor?
Aye.
All right.
Aye.
Move on.
The
last recommendation that we have that we worked up is relates to the nurse family partnership program, and it's. We've got three pages here, lots of references on this program. So let me just, again, go over some of the highlights we talked about this at the last meeting. The national program, it also has a New York implementation in several counties. It was actually born here in New York, Santa Monica, Dr. Old. And the program targets high risk, which includes all low-income first-time mothers to begin a trajectory of 2.5 years of home visits that are staged various times. So home visits are both directed at the mom and then eventually postpartum directed as well to a number of aspects around parenting and child care and so on. The current program, there's an active program in New York City, in Monroe County, in Gonzaga. Medicaid has begun to pay for part of this program through a specific vehicle called Department of Case Management, which allows Medicaid to pay for some portion of the services that fit under a targeted case management definition, which had a lot to do with helping to arrange and organize and coordinate services, but does not cover the bulk of what these visits entail by registered nurses. This particular proposal is to have Medicaid cover the full cost of the Nurse Family Partnership Program, in which case the TCM components of what we are doing currently would essentially go away. There are projections here, and this is a big item. We have some projections here in terms of the number. Looking at the current enrollment, so the other thing that we benefit to understand is that the program itself is somewhat limited. That is, that the ability to program don't exist in every county. Variations of finding RNs who are appropriately trained and part of this program. And we look at currently the numbers that are enrolled in the programs that exist in Monroe, Onondaga, and New York City, on average about 12% or so of first-time mothers who we see eligible are enrolled in the program. And that's the number that really has to go up or down. It could go up if there was some broad availability of the program. But I think the number of the programs actually have slots, so this is not necessarily just constrained by the number of slots. So, for example, New York City, which is kind of the super expensive in Monroe County, but also limited by the willingness of mothers to participate in the program. And it's a long commitment, although the average length of time that folks are in the nurse family partnership, on average, is about 2.5 years, although that's sort of the maximum. There are a number of benefits that have been evidence-based. There's an actual study that was done to show a return on investment, but the return includes some non-Medicaid-type returns in addition to some more limited Medicaid return. And there is, I think, still some ongoing questions about the degree to which this impacts directly Medicaid funding, things like adverse birth outcomes and so on. There is data, and there is included in here some specific New York City, New York data about various kinds of improvements, reduction in childhood injuries and emergency room visits and so on. And much of those reductions are what we've secured savings in here. And now there is, there's an ROI number of 570 without specific calculation of the savings in the program.
I think the other thing is that we just know that a lot of the savings accrue outside of the program in other areas.
Correct. The last page before the references, this is some data we asked the city's program to try to collect whatever they had that was New York specific. And on whatever outcomes that might be of interest, and you can see some of the what they have found in terms of looking at women who are in the program versus citywide data. Increased rate of breastfeeding, which we talked about earlier, increased rate of exclusive breastfeeding in 2 months, increased type of developmental assessments, increased use of contraception and spacing of pregnancies, a higher rate of infancy up to date on immunization, and then some of the sort of non-Medicaid, non-clinical endpoints around completion of high school degree or GED, engagement with fathers in care, and not on the specific, but I've seen elsewhere, are reductions in domestic violence and interactions in the justice system and so on. You can see that the costs of the program are not, even at a 12% potential enrollment, the annual costs are pretty high, about $6,500 on average. This varies considerably between city and state. Reflecting general labor costs and other costs. The estimation here is about $40 million spend. If this was rolled out statewide, understanding that statewide really means predominantly New York City, Monroe, and Onondaga, which accounts for about three-quarters of that number of estimated around 5,800 first-time mothers that would be enrolled. I don't think that we backed out of this cost, the current TCM cost in here. That would be Those have been fairly modest to date in terms of uptake of that particular Medicaid funding.
I believe this is the gross demo cost in the counties that we did, not just the TCM cost.
In terms of the participation in this, you indicated there were a number of factors that limited it. One was the number of slots, but also there was a limitation of willingness to participate. So to some degree, do you have some self-selection in here in comparing these numbers?
Well, it's a good question, though. So the issue would be, in any of the studies that look at this, is there a way of trying to, are these sort of the healthier women, so the
more
engaged and so on. And I think it's impossible to adjust for a level of engagement in this or in any other kind of care management or so on. I do know that the studies try to evaluate using control groups women who had were equally at high risk of adverse outcomes, whether they're maternal or related to child care outcomes or criminal justice outcomes and so on. But being able to evaluate or adjust for level of engagement, I think, could have I don't think that they were able to do that. I don't think most of the studies like this, there's not a very good way to adjust for, for that factor at a fair point.
I think just being in New York City and running a prenatal program, because the people who can do it in the city are outside of the clinic right now, there is a referral process, and so some of it is a barrier that actually exists versus having someone in your clinic who you could just send the patient over to. I think however it's implemented and whoever is permitted to do this may increase the actual access to the service.
So, other thoughts, comments?
Which I guess leads to who is going to be able to do this.
I agree. I think that's going to be a... Well, I hope, when there's dollars, people will step up to the plate.
I think the way it was brought out in New York City was on an RFP basis, so you had to go through this whole process. And so the entities that had nurses were the more likely ones to apply and win the application process, so that's how it ended up kind of where it is.
I mean, okay.
Was the idea that this would be a standalone program that would be funded by Medicaid for all comers that are in Medicaid, or how was this going to be?
Yes. So currently, right now, the way we're funding CPM is sort of cart this program, or Medicaid funding of it is currently carved out, if you will, plan. So plans don't have any responsibility. I think the way we began it's not in here and discussed it, but the way in which I envisioned it to be implemented is like, it would be like any other benefit. For women in fee-for-service, they would access it via standalone fee-for-service benefit. If for women that were in managed care, it would be part of the managed care benefit.
So what if you get, I've got my own program internal to our operation. It's not the nurse business, but it's social outreach with my own nurses involved with us now. This gets to be kind of interesting because, we do not just do the preemies, but we do the all women that are high risk. So how is this going to work with the rate? Is my question. Given the fact that the cost savings are over 15 years and not necessarily going to be coming to the health plan.
Well, that's, I think I view immunization or some other preventive services in the same way in terms of cost savings.
So you'd be a fee that pays for it. So.
Right. Yeah. Other kinds of colon cancer, cancer screening and so on. I think the way plans that had programs that were identical, that had identical criteria for gifts and roles, I suppose that would say, great, do the plan program, but as I understand your program and most other plans, it's not this program.
It's all commerce, yeah.
It may be everyone, regardless of what trimester they're in,
right.
May or may not be an RN.
Right.
And this is a particular structured program around which the national program would say, it's important to be fidelity to the model. And it's not, there would be women who would, not be eligible for this, but be eligible for the kind of program and care management that you do.
Well, I still like to say, but the thing is, how is this going to reflect, and maybe this is some other time discussion with some of these things, how is it going to be reflected in the plan rate? Because the cost is $6,500 per a woman and child later on down for, well, it's like 2.5 years or whatever. And there's no tangible payback per se for quite a while, and a lot of it is purely societal, you know, the corrections and all that.
Great.
I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road here.
And similarly, you know, how it would be handled in the world of CAP. Same type issue of savings go down the road and not necessarily Medicaid.
You know, we have a lot of advocates for this. I think we probably have the record number of letters. And so we have a lot of thoughtful people in the community who would work with us to figure these questions out. And what I would suggest is for this one, let's convene such a group at some level, whether it's virtual or conference call or meeting, and start asking exactly these questions.
I agree. I think this is a great proposal, and I think the evidence is all here. It's an evidence-based program. It's a great benefit. Just the devil's in the details. How do you really pull it off and implement the process?
And this would include, I mean, what we are doing at the state level is already having these conversations across criminal justice, education, health, old age, OASIS, around high-risk communities. It makes sense that we also continue it at this level. And so that's another form where I can introduce it.
But I think also a valid question, you know, if we're talking about really no savings in the first year, and is there gross numbers on each year, dollars?
It's better than you share.
It's gross. So, and we're capped, that means the money for this comes from somewhere else. So where is it coming from? Because we're not evaluating this as a No, I mean, you know, it sounds like a great program, but that means something else doesn't get paid for. And what is that something else?
So this is, I mean, it raises a great point that on break from Mark and I were talking about, which is sort of the relative, we've not had a conversation about the relative value of what we put. And that, I mean, that's a really great point, which is, you know, we've talked about obesity in the context of that, like this one as well, and yeah, like this specialist. We took off some as well. But it does the group, I mean, if it's important to sort of use all the imbalance, I would see that would probably be more than what we'll have now in terms of expenditure versus savings, reflecting the reality that it's always easier to spend money for some reason than it is to save money.
You know, I will propose that we do this experiment after this. After we're done with all these, that we send out the list to everyone, and you rank them from 1 through 11, and then we compile the results and see what we get. I think that alone would
be interesting.
Yeah. That'd
be interesting.
And then we can dive deeper into areas and ask why you did it or what you think of it.
I think the notion of the global path, the notion that we're trying to move towards, it is a fixed amount of money, and there are opportunity costs in doing one thing versus another. How do we not only assess each individual thing on its merit, but how do we think about the whole? And that's really very challenging, but I think where we need to go to.
So that brings up the question of whether, when we're looking at the evidence, we should look at cost-effectiveness analyses that are published. Because the very purpose of those analyses is to quantify the amount of benefit. So that, for example, you could say how much additional high-quality life is added by one intervention versus another intervention versus another intervention. I mean, there are definitely tools out there and published studies that do exactly that.
But probably not across this range of interventions, idiopathic short stature, you know. I find it hard to think someone's got a quality analysis.
Right, not a short stature. But your comment really is, Scott, I'm understanding, is that that's the purpose of those types of analyses, is to have the denominator uniform.
Yeah, that's exactly their purpose, is to be helpful in this sort of discussion.
I think about that the ranking is helpful, even if it's somewhat subjective in bringing together the variables of relative effectiveness clinically. In some cases, a unidimensional perspective on savings that we presented, because usually it was something we could count. I still think it's helpful because what would happen from here is we write this report, these go up to the mothership with many other proposals. I think expressing the ranking would help that entity to chew through them. The other thing on some of these larger spending initiatives is that the Payment Reform Committee yesterday voted on the side of the duals to pursue some kind of a waiver to potentially try to leverage additional federal resources. And so if waivers were pursued, that could impact the global cap. There could be opportunities to potentially bring in some evidence-based spending as an experiment with the feds on quality improvement in the Medicaid program for New York. These could become centerpieces of a waiver or a waiver description. That may idle some of the larger spend items until the waiver pieces are enacted, but it keeps them alive without having to cut something in the next year to spend. And I think the ranking helps us figure out, what can we do now, what could we put off.
Is there a possibility that, I think you were referring it to Dr. Shaw, that you could bring in other agencies with portions of their budget to help offset some of this cost? It may never have been done before, but clearly this program shows impact in the other areas. So why should Medicaid be carrying
I will have that conversation. I can tell you what the answer is, but I will have that conversation. Well, no, I mean, we're looking at this example right now with the 10 areas of the state where the worst crime, lowest outcomes educationally, worst health outcomes, and we're focusing on those 10 areas. Troy is one of them. That's not why we invited you. But the reality is when the first exercise we did is saying, what are we spending by agency in each of these regions? And when you look at criminal justice, it's 100,000. And when you look at health, it's 10 million. So the amount of money, I think it's not about the amount of money, it's about the integration of programs. It's about having someone who's being released from jail have a plan for health care so they're not just trying to get into jail to get health care, which is happening, believe it or not, and other things from the educational perspective. And that kind of integration is what we're working on right now. Not necessarily money, but there's still a lot to be had just by having those conversations.
So there are some issues with this problem in terms of there being national grant funds, including grant dollars from the Fed that help support this program. And, similar to the conversation I think we had before about expanding the federal program, so a little bit different. There's some concern about placement of those grant funds. Now, one could argue potentially that the grant fund sort of having Medicaid reimbursement helps expand the reach of that, and that's exactly what the agency would say. So other women they may be eligible to be uninsured or have other kinds of insurance status. But I think we do need to be mindful that evidence-based home visiting programs, which this is one of, that the White House, and I think CMS are very much in favor of looking for states to take on, have been funded through a number of different grants. Now, how long those grants will go on, of course, we don't really know. But included in the information that we did, I think we sent around from the city was a letter back from CMS about how states might approach covering this, and seems to indicate sort of a willingness to think about CMS and federal participation in the program.
I have a suggestion back to the ranking idea. Rather than rank all 11, the danger is that we might all systematically rank the spends higher than the saves. So perhaps we should rank the spends and the saves separately.
But, we're also not limited to these 11. I mean, there may be other things that we pay for that.
Right.
I'm sort of thinking how we're
right.
supposed
no,
to
but
pay those
spirit
out.
Of
maybe
the
maybe
the exercise is more for me, to see where there is variation. Relative to whether it's heterogeneity. And if there's, there's some central principles that reinforce some of the principles we explicated or otherwise that we haven't yet articulated, that may be what we're aiming for. It's not really, maybe it'll provide guidance to the mothership when they go through it, but it's really about, we want this whole package. I don't want to see
we have to really have a need to prioritize. Okay, that's the one more time. I'm not sure if we do. It depends, right? That's part of your...
That's what I'm wondering about.
Right.
What if we went through the process and we all
right.
prioritized the
small
right. system? So you want to take the cost element out of the equation when we rank it. So we could even give that as an explicit...
So put the cost in, basically right. say that this in terms of prioritizing, it's the one that cost that we have to
yeah.
prioritize.
No, no, no. He said separate them into the ones that are
yeah.
positive spend versus negative
right.
spend.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, right. I think what I'm trying to avoid is everybody ranking the spend proposal higher than the
right.
save proposal. Could we just ask everyone to just not think of cost as part of their ranking? And other than cost, think of value in every other way. Societal benefits, disparities benefit, patient-centeredness, et cetera.
Well, you don't need to rank the save ones
right.
because that's going to, I mean, as long as they're meritorious, they're going to save you money. It's the spend ones that you've got to worry about whether they're going to cost too much money.
I would think more in terms of what are the values of the proposal. Forget money. Like,
mm-hmm.
what is the value of doing, you know, expanding a benefit of the patient safety aspects of this proposal, or the fact that it's a USPSTF A or B, those kinds of
right.
Across the board.
But on the spend ones is the issue about whether you're going to have enough money.
Right. And
so
that's what I'm saying, take cost out of the equation and rank all of them on their merits and value outside of cost. Forget spend or save. But I'm open to suggestions.
Well, the other thing that I'm thinking is, you know, our job really is to evaluate whether these sort of things, they're efficacious, I guess, right? And the MRT will make decisions. They're going to have to live within a global budget, right? So they're going to say, okay, these look like they might make sense to spend money on, but that means I'm going to have to figure out where else I'm going to cut. So maybe we just somehow incorporate that into our overall principle and not do that here.
Well, let us take that back, figure out whether we may want one or two rankings or something like that and present that to the group.
Yeah, I mean, no way in, but I wouldn't miss the opportunity for this group to have much more to suggest some sort of prioritization
yeah.
around it. And they can obviously take it or leave it, but we've had a lot more conversation here about
proposals. Well, in the last process, things were ranked high, low, but, you know, we did all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think that's what's going to happen for the whole mothership level of proposals as well. But it wouldn't hurt to give guidance to the community level because we've had some time to discuss it. Right. Anything else on the nurse family partnership proposal? All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay. I will... I
just want to say that from my perspective, this is a great group. Broadly represented, very reasonable measure, yet stimulating dialogue. And I've had fun working for you guys. And I'd love at some point to keep this alive because those of us who have been working sort of with limited resources, smart, bright, energetic people that stay up for all hours working on this stuff, but not enough of us. It's really nice to have this kind of help. It's really nice to have this kind of time to actually talk about these issues. And it's been fun having this specific group work with. You guys have done really nice work here.
So we have, in terms of the next step, we have one minor change to one of the two documents to do. We have some proposals on some of the comments that were made. We're going to figure out what we want you to do relative to ranking and get back to you about that and we'll start the report. And again, I think it's left aside in this process. When do you as a group feel comfortable sending it over to, I'm only just asking the question now, you know, if we clean up these minor things, is it all the group feel comfortable letting the MRT generally see where we are so that they can
yes.
weigh in sooner rather than later?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll see another round of these things.
Right. Right. Yeah. And then, again, based on what we hear from the larger MRT group, we may need to meet, maybe email, maybe nothing, that we have to adjust. It wouldn't shock me if we had to have a call to respond to some regulatory memo.
It would be great if we could sew up the rest of the comment process and work with them through email. I mean, we could get back the proposals with the changes that we made and then just perhaps collect comments and email. And we'll try to discipline that a little bit. Maybe
20 mil all the way up to the person.
Yeah, then we have a double. Yeah.
Sorry, so there was one issue I just realized that we didn't address relative to the process, which was a comment that was put forward about who should be on the group. And there was some back and forth about this, and there are some suggestions that there should be, specifically that there should clearly be a consumer advocate on the group, on this expert panel going forward. There was other conversation about we really want to name all the folks that might be on this. You know, maybe we need an ethicist, maybe we need an economist, maybe we need a OBGYN, you know, and some concern about going down a rabbit hole and trying to name specific folks that should be part of it. But I want to be, I'd rather conclude this now than and sort of do a lot of email exchange on this and get a sense of where the group is. And again, if you take out the document on the process, basically talked about external group on benefits will be created from advisory group of Medicaid. Medicaid advisory group will consist of an external group of experts that provide general guidance, the review process, review benefit design, line policy and program goals, specific input. Benefit reviews are challenging, high potential impact, controversial, meet quarterly, and so on.
So let me just preface this by saying that I tend to, two comments. One is, I think that it's vital that we have the patient's voice at the table. A Medicaid beneficiary, ideally, you know, who is subject to the program, to be part of this conversation going forward. And you know, to the extent that we tried, given the time and the constraints, the person we identified lost their benefits the day of our first meeting. So we tried. But that doesn't mean that we can't do it right when we build this up going forward.
We came eligible for Medicare, though, so it's a happy story. We're not insured.
They ate into a...
Right.
So I believe strongly that we should have a patient's voice. And not just one. I'm not saying any given arbitrary number. I think we need an active voice of the patient ethics and conversation going forward as we design the benefits around what their needs are. The second point I want to make is I also believe that it's important to be flexible. You know, if you start putting boxes around things and not boxes around other things, you run into risk. We're seeing this in other boards that I'm on where we're like, oh, well, so-and-so is representing these four hats. What they're not representing, we're forgetting about this other group. And that is a slippery slope. You know, what's worked really well in this group is that we've had folks who represent their specific organization, but also represent themselves, represent patients, represent the provider perspective, and the broader perspective. And this group has really gelled because of that kind of approach. I think it's important to keep that benefit going forward. And that's why I would personally, and everyone to chime in, suggest that we keep it broader, recognizing that we do need certainly a patient's voice here, in addition to the many voices we do have represented. I believe
can we include just language like that, that the expert group will reconvene and there will...
I think it's fine. I just want to talk about the realities of the situation. You know,
and all attempts will be made to include the voice of the patient.
My sense would be that you can add in there perhaps if the term expert and appropriate stakeholder that would also include representation.
That could
and
be.
Then you're not boxed in at any one particular stakeholder, but at least you've articulated that you want the consumer to be at the table.
So you could. And here's my concern about stakeholders. So is this a stake? Everybody who has a stake in the benefit should be around the table, or do we want... Is this a conversation about the evidence and the benefits?
Well, we do want to
have. Yeah, I mean, I think there are patients and there are patients. There are experts and there are experts. There are, you know, hospital associations and other hospitals. So that's the problem. It's understanding our priorities, our principles, and everything using that lens, and then my explicitly saying we need to have a patient. I would hope that would be.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I mean, let's leave the language and the wordsmithing aside so, you know, folks who can spend the time on it. But, you know, the idea that, you know, you got to have a patient who's in the system at the table to me makes perfect sense.
I also agree that trying to sculpt, you know, the rest of the group with any more precision than what's here now probably would send us down the wrong path. I'll be very honest, and maybe it's just, you know, because I'm not, you know, not smart enough, but many of the comments, I couldn't tell who you were representing except an honest, thoughtful opinion. And I'm suggesting that that's kind of what you're looking for. So.
I think what really gave this group a lot of validity was the number of clinicians. I think that that has to be counted.
I'm very comfortable with what you laid out, and I appreciate your commitment to SLB patient voice. That's good enough for me. I'm sympathetic to what you're trying to avoid. Having tried to put some of these things together in the legislature, various advisory committees, you know, two of this one, two of that one. And I think you're right that, you know, it creates a situation where there's probably less buy-in to the overall goal rather than to, you know, the people back in the district, you know. And I think for these types of decisions, you sort of have to keep the right temperature. You know, I've been lobbied by, you know, all sorts of interests and all sorts of consumers and, you know, wrongly on all sides. And I think the thing that this has going for it is a sort of a buy-in to the overall charge that he gave us at the beginning, which was really improving the quality of Medicaid benefits for beneficiaries.
I don't think anyone's fortunate or necessary at all. Especially every adult Medicare recipient is more of an expert than I at Medicaid. So I think you just leave it at that. The, you know, the agreement that we all agree that we need to have the public. And I think you're expert at it.
So then I am taking this as a charge to not change the language, but the principle is that this group will certainly expand in a specific direction. And that we will try to convene shortly.
We can
shortly. Great. Thank you.
Thank you all. I'll try to change your email.
Folks on the phone, any before we close, any comments? Henry? Arnie?
Oh, very inspirational. Thank you for the opportunity.
All righty.
Thank you.
Thank you.